We'll call to order the interim Senate Interim Committee on Environment and Natural Resources. Today is the, what is today? What's the date? Let me make sure. The 12th of December. And we have a fairly full agenda today. So we're going to get going. And to kick us off, we have a special guest. Our esteemed Senate President is here to talk about a legislative concept that's near and dear to his heart. I don't know if it's his top priority for the entire legislative session. I have not heard of him discuss this legislative priority in the Oregonian or Oregon Live or Statesman Journal prior to today, but I do believe it's important enough that he is here. So, Mr. President?
Well, Mr. Chair.
And whoever else you would like to accompany you.
Mr. Chair, as he comes up, you know, I understand he's going to be gracing the room with the Judiciary Committee on Wednesday with three bills, so we'll figure out.
Oh. Okay.
What is his high priority?
My name is Peter Courtney, and I'm a state senator from District 11 here in Salem. Chair Edwards, Chair Olson, Senator Bazansky, Senator Whitson. The reason I'm testifying is it occurred to me that I have many times made statements that the heart and soul of the Oregon legislative process is its committee structure. Not every legislature has the very strong committee structure that we have. In addition, ever since we've created legislative days, I've always emphasized relying on the committees to try to get a head start on bills. But I seldom, if ever, have gone before an interim committee as I'm doing today, and I'm going to do as Senator Brzezinski said regarding several other bills. Because if I've said that it's a good idea that others go, I should go. So that's the only reason I'm doing it, Your Honor, if for no other reasons. And it so happens that this is the first of several bills I'll be testifying on the next several days. And I'm here to support what the LC 1845 and animal trapping. Animal trapping has played a monumental role in the early days of our state. Fur trapping led the exploration and settlement of our state into our state. It was a major industry at the time. While it is not the industry it once was in Oregon, fur trapping continues today. This piece of legislation was brought to me by the Humane Society. It seeks to continue to allow trapping to make it a much more humane practice. At the heart of the measure is a requirement that traps be checked once every 24 hours to protect unintended victims and reduce the suffering to animals. 24-hour check would be required for the trapping of all mammals except when a property owner is trapping the following animals on his or her own property: mice, rats, gophers, mountain beavers, and moles. Legislation also requires mandatory reporting of all animals trapped and mandatory signage when traps are placed on public lands to protect humans and their pets recreating in the areas. I thank you for allowing me to come testify and issuing a statement. This is not as peculiar as you may think. I have a list of states in here, and I'm frankly amazed at the states that already have a 24-hour trap checking time, or what they call a daily trap checking time, from all over the states, the Deep South, the West, New England, the East. There are many states that already require this type of check on traps. So I do thank you for allowing me to come and testify for this bill. And I also believe that my statement is, it's in written form, has also been presented to you. So thank you.
Thank you. Kelly?
Hi. Good afternoon, Senator Chair Edwards and committee members. My name is Kelly Peterson, and I reside in Portland, Oregon, and I work for the Humane Society of the United States. And I will just add that in Oregon currently there are about four different types of trap check times for wildlife. They range from 48 hours to 30 days, and unfortunately black bears, there are no trap check times for them because they're listed as game mammals. So what we're seeking to do is pass a law that would make our trap check times consistent and enforceable and humane in Oregon. And there's been quite a history on this issue in terms of trap check times. The Oregon Fish and Wildlife Commission took this issue up in 2004 and again in 2012 and have made some incremental changes. But unfortunately, the laws are such that if a predatory animal, and of course there's all these different definitions, predatory animals are defined as coyotes, rabbits, birds, rodents, swine, but primarily coyotes, the trap check time for those is 76 hours. However, if you're trapping coyotes for damage, that trap check time is 7 days. There are trap check times for conibear traps, quick kill traps, which oftentimes, and some, you know, the animal does not walk into it in the proper way, and the animal is suffering for days. And those trap check times here in Oregon are 30 days. It's very inconsistent, and we're grateful to Senator Courtney for bringing this bill forward. We have some studies that we can submit later, but that they do show that, you know, even in a 24-hour period, hemorrhaging occurs, fracturing, animals struggling to get out of the traps. And we know that one factor in terms of the degree of suffering is the length of time that an animal is suffering in a trap. And we think it's reasonable and very good humane policy to have a 24-hour trap check time like the nearly 30 states across the country. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for the panel? Senator Whitsitt?
Thank you. A comment and a couple of questions. Mm-hmm. First, Mr. President, I appreciate you putting your name on this bill. I think that all committee bills should have the name on it, regardless of what I think of the bill. And I think I've said for a long time that a member's name should be on every bill that comes through here, and I appreciate you taking that leadership. A couple of questions. One has to do with on page 3, section 2, sub 6. We're going to create a wildlife control operator permit program. This is at the same time that our governor is slashing the funding to wildlife services. How's that going to work?
Well, let me, Senator Edwards, Chair Edwards, Senator Whitsitt, and other members of the committee, we will, the issue should, I think, be debated on its merits, up or down. In terms of the budgetary decisions that have been made down the hall, I see those as separate decisions. And one of the reasons I like our the way we govern here is this is the policy committee. Very much, I think this policy should be debated. In terms of the ways and means impact of this, that's another discussion. But I do think that we should not hesitate today to discuss this and perhaps move it forward, should the wisdom of this committee be that way. Then the budgetary issue should be fought at another time. But whether or not how it looks, if you're asking me how it looks with the budget that the governor's presented, her budget, I don't think it should preclude any of us for introducing bills or legislation that we think is important for the people of Oregon or some part of the people of Oregon. So that's a generic statement. I'm not trying to avoid your question. I'm just trying to answer the best I can that I didn't check what the governor's budget was going to be on this, nor did I check what the budget of the co-chair's budget is going to be, which I've asked for in January. Rather, this is an issue that I didn't realize. I wrote a letter back in 2004 on this very thing, asking the commission to step up. So it's been something I've been involved in for a long time, and I will continue to pursue it for as long as I'm here to try to get this done. If I'm stopped because of policy issue matter, policy reasons, okay. If subsequently I'm stopped because of budgetary issues, okay, but I'll just continue the battle. So that's all I can say.
Second question.
Yeah.
Has to do with the language in the bill talks about trapping under ORS 497.142, but this bill expands that goes from 48 hours to 24 hours checking, and then expands it to also to 498.012 and the entire ORS Chapter 610, which seems I haven't had time to go back and look, but I just wanted to point out, and I wonder if you could discuss how much that expands this requirement to trap now to check a trap every 24 hours.
Chair Edwards, could I defer to an expert witness, please?
Sure.
Take it.
Okay. Senator Whitsitt and committee members. So there are definitions. There are fur bears. It would expand it so that fur bears are currently a 48-hour trap check time. Predatory animals are currently 76-hour trap check times. But if you're trapping for damage, it's 7 days. If you're using a conibear trap or quick kill, it's 30 days. There are no trap check times for game mammals, which include bears and cougars and deer. But so it would incorporate all of these fur bears, predatory animals, game mammals, with the exception of which I could list some of these animals if you want.
You've answered the question. That's
okay.
That's what I was afraid it was
okay.
Going to do. Thank you.
Okay.
General Olson.
Thank you. Mr. President, thank you, sir.
Are we going or what? Is he going to do something on my?
I am going to. You told me several months ago.
Patience.
Relax. Settle down.
I did say that.
I'm trying to meet that criteria, if you will, please. Under this bill, if we have a person that is licensed to go out and trap beaver. Will you restrict his ability to make income by putting on a 24-hour notification rather than the 48 because it'll limit the amount of traps he could put out? Either.
Yes.
Either.
Yeah. Senator Olson and committee members, years ago I was on a committee that was appointed by the commission that involved trappers and some others, I think Audubon Society of Portland, and we would debate many of these issues. And, you know, I think there's about 900 licensed trappers in the state of Oregon. Most of them at that time were trapping for damage, and there weren't a lot that were making money to sell the pelt. I would say that if you're checking your trap every 24 hours, you are freeing, you're removing that animal and potentially reopening that trap. And you would be potentially, getting, you'd have the opportunity to take another, animal, which in turn would be selling that pelt. So I think it would be negligible, to be really honest. I've seen there's at least 30 states that have 24-hour trap check times. While I haven't compared, and I don't know that there would be a difference, I haven't compared the states in terms of how many pelts are sold out of the states that have 24-hour trap check times to see if that has an impact. But I would say I did some comparison on the counties back in 2012 and how many traps or how many animals were trapped in each of the counties, and I did. I have the numbers from the western and eastern counties. That it looks like there were about 10,000 plus animals trapped in the western counties, and about 14,000 trapped in eastern counties. I would just say that I don't think the 24-hour trap check time would make a significant difference.
Well, let me, Chair Edwards, yeah. Senator Olson, I'm just going to make a statement. It may. It may. And I support that. I support this bill. And if some individuals aren't going to have as many traps because of it, then they're not going to have as many traps. So I'm not going to avoid that whatsoever. I don't know if we can answer your question, but to me, the magnitude of what we're dealing with here, just the way we treat our animals, especially those that are going to make profit off the animal, whatever, they should be visiting those traps every 24 hours. So it could very well restrict them And we don't know that. I don't think, in listening to testimony, we have enough research. And I don't think we'll ever be able to give you an up or down answer. But from a philosophical standpoint, I believe those traps should be checked every 24 hours.
Mr. Chair,
yep.
Are we going to have anyone in to testify, any trappers come in to testify in this?
That'll be a decision that will be made in February.
Okay.
And I won't be here. I don't know.
If the bill gets scheduled for hearing.
Yeah. So that'll be, I mean, this is just
of course
to introduce the concept, right. Let us start thinking about it, and then public hearings will be scheduled if the chair at that time, if the bill ends up here in this committee, and if whoever is chairing the committee at that time schedules it for public hearing, then you know the process.
He's pretty cocky, isn't he?
So
who's that?
No, I just won't be here.
The chair. So.
It's just laying the facts out.
I think we all know that I'm not going to be here. So.
Yeah, but your thoughts will be with us.
So will the force.
Anything else for panelists?
Thank you.
Thank you both.
Take so much time because I know you got a heavy agenda. So thank you very much, Your Honor.
All right. Next up, we've got the report from the Wood Smoke Work Group. So if Rachel Sakata and Palmer Mason could come forward, that'd be great.
Good afternoon, Chair Edwards and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Palmer Mason. I'm the legislative advisor at the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality. You've asked us to be here today to talk about the Wood Smoke Report. This report was a legislatively required report that came out of a legislatively created work group in 2015. House Bill 3068 directed DEQ to create and appoint a work group to look at wood smoke reduction. We have gone through that process, and Rachel will tell you more about what we did in that regard. And we have delivered the report to the legislature, and we appreciate the opportunity to talk a bit about that. I do want to recognize that one of our commissioners, the current chair of our commission, Jane O'Keefe, who is here in the room, chaired that work group and spent with Rachel quite a bit of time going to the far corners of Oregon and working with the work group to get as much public input and thinking around this issue. And one last comment. These days at DEQ and Oregon Health Authority, at least, we talk a lot about air pollution, quite a bit about air toxics as they come from industrial sources, and in working with Senator Demarest, quite a bit of time around clean diesel. But I think this report does offer us a good reminder that there's a third issue, that a third major source of air pollution, and that is wood smoke. And this is a particular source that has both health effects as well as economic effects, particularly for some of our rural communities. So we are grateful that the committee granted us some time to talk about this. So thank you.
Great. Good afternoon, Chair Edwards and members of the committee. My name is Rachel Sakata, and I'm an air quality planner with the DEQ, and I'm the key staff person who led the wood smoke work group. So just go ahead and get started. So basically, why is wood smoke a concern? I've talked to you about this before, but you know, wood smoke is a problem in all communities across Oregon as they struggle to meet the federal health standards for particulate matter, or PM2.5. And so particulate matter wood smoke can be easily inhaled, it can reach the deepest part of the lungs, and is known to cause or contribute to respiratory disease, asthma, heart attacks, and premature death. And so, and also, as Palmer mentioned, wood smoke contains toxic organic compounds, which are known to cause cancer. And so overall, wintertime residential wood burning is the most significant source of fine particulate matter in most communities on the verge of non-attainment. So this just kind of gives you a map of areas, and what does non-attainment mean? I should explain that as well. It basically means that the area is violating the federal health standard for air pollutants. And so Oregon has had a long history of addressing non-attainment in communities. Back in the 1980s, we had a number of communities throughout the state that were violating the standards, but we were able to bring them back into compliance. And we're still challenged over the years because EPA has made the particulate health standard progressively more protective for public health. So as you can see from the chart here, in 2006, which was the latest revision, it lowered the standard by half, down to 35 micrograms per meter cubed. And so it's made it difficult for past non-attainment communities to stay in compliance, and it has put new ones at risk of non-attainment. And so across Oregon, the high PM2.5 levels driving the non-attainment risk are universally caused by wood smoke. So because of this concern about the health and economic effect of wood smoke in many communities across Oregon, Representative Johnson sponsored House Bill 3068 during the 2015 legislative session. And so the bill, as Palmer mentioned, directed DEQ to conduct a study to and develop recommendations for ways for legislation to reduce wood smoke in Oregon, and particularly in communities where attainment of the national air quality standards is a concern. And the bill also directed DEQ to explore options for switching out old wood stoves for cleaner burning devices, to look into the use and production of biomass fuel, to explore options for reducing the cost of wood stove alternatives during poor air quality days. So this just kind of, DEQ formed a work group to help conduct the study and develop recommendations, and this gives you an idea of some of the work group members. They came from all over the state, different entities. We have a couple of work group members here in the audience as well, which is great. And so they, the work group members reflected a range of stakeholders affected by wood smoke and biomass, and it included those folks from rural and urban communities. And so we held 5 work group meetings, and in the middle of the process, we also conducted a roadshow around the state where we visited 7 communities, so those are highlighted up there on the map. So we really wanted to get across all of Oregon to hear, to get feedback and hear additional suggestions for work group consideration. And the work group took these slots and considered them in their final recommendations to DEQ and this to the legislature. And the work group had really good discussions regarding the realities of how communities are trying to tackle the wood smoke issue, and what will and will not work, such as an acknowledgement of a strong culture of wood stove use, lack of staffing to implement programs, also an easily accessible wood supply, and economic barriers for struggling communities. So the recommendations provided to the legislature focus on what is needed to be successful in tackling the wood smoke issue and helping these communities. Overall, these recommendations basically enhance state and local partnerships focused on reducing the health effects of wood smoke and to remove potential regulatory barriers to economic development that could be caused by federal non-attainment designation in local communities. And so to achieve the goal of helping these Oregon communities, the report highlights 3 priority recommendations for consideration. So first of all, DEQ and the work group identify one of the key pieces as increasing local community funding. Locally run wood smoke programs are critical to maintaining or achieving clean air, at least part-time programs are required for some of the former non-attainment communities under their federally approved air quality clean air plans. And so local communities, basically, they understand the challenges of their area and can craft effective wood smoke reduction programs that include wood stove curtailment and education and outreach messages specifically tailored for their residents. So, for example, there are wood stove curtailment programs that basically ask or require residents to curtail the use of their wood-burning appliance during poor air quality days. Senator Whitson, I know you're familiar with that in your area. And they can be either voluntary or mandatory depending on the severity of the air quality program and available resources. And this measure can be really effective at reducing wood smoke and has been successfully implemented in a number of communities such as Klamath Falls, Lakeview, Oak Ridge, Eugene, Hillsborough in Washington County, Prineville, Burns, Medford, just to name a few. And so basically, that's one of the most effective programs. Other locally implemented reduction programs also include the ability to expand education and outreach for communities to solicit grants and matching funds to conduct their work. And so right now, current state funding we have about $170,000 per biennium to give to these communities, and it only covers part of the cost to implement minimal wood smoke reduction programs in 7 communities. And so by increasing state funding for local wood smoke reduction by a range of $550,000 to $700,000 per biennium, each community could then employ a full or part-time dedicated staff person to implement various programs mentioned above, including the wood stove curtailment program, expanding the education and outreach, and administering wood stove changeout programs. Communities also indicated that knowing that there is consistent and sustained funding to help with their work makes it easier for them to budget and also to solicit grants and matching funds to help buttress their work. So local implemented community programs are one of the most effective ways to reduce wood smoke in an area. And without their partnership and involvement, many communities will be at continued risk or potentially in danger of violating the federal health air quality standard. And increased funding will allow these areas to fully address or enhance their ability to address wood smoke. So another one of the key recommendations that was provided was sustained funding for wood stove changeouts. And so there are approximately 150,000 uncertified wood stoves in the state, and these old stoves are a reason why, you know, a lot of areas are at risk of violating the health standards. For example, old stoves can be 3 to 10 times more polluting than a certified stove. And Oregon has had a long and successful history of replacing wood stoves in certain communities, but money is sporadic and limited to just one-time only grants. So this just kind of gives you an idea of some of the wood stove change-up programs that we've had in the past. We've had $2 million that we were able to give to a number of communities, and then most recently $1.5 million for Klamath Falls and Lakeview to do wood stove change-outs. And sustained funding is the only way to ensure that communities have a consistent, reliable source of funding. The recommendations focus on doing these replacements to be able to lower particulate matter levels in an area within the next 5 to 10 years, particularly in critical air sheds where air quality is a concern. And we can't afford to wait and hope that a grant will come along. We need to put a funding source in place that a community can rely upon. And so, basically, an allocation in the range of $3 to $5 million per biennium could help target high-risk communities and would support a meaningful level of effort to replace old wood stoves. And this kind of this chart here provides sort of a rough estimate of the number of stoves that could be replaced by funding amount. So we kind of tried to provide a range between $1 to $5 million just to give you an idea. And so it sort of gives you an example of what the change-out program covers. For example, it could cover the full replacement costs, or which would be the top part of the line. So for example, for the $1 million, you replace 290 stoves if you covered the full replacement cost and installation of a stove. The 700 number for the 700 stoves replaced would be so if you were giving partial rebates. And from past change-out programs, many communities offer a combination of the two. But the allocation of the full replacement versus partial replacement sort of depends on the makeup of the community. So, for example, maybe a community like Oak Ridge or Lakeview, there may be a high percentage of full rebates, replacement rebates due to economic needs as opposed to other areas of the state. And also the type of device being replaced has an effect on the emission reduction and also the cost of how many devices can be replaced. So, for example, pellet stove provides greater emissions reduction, but it also is a little more expensive than a certified wood stove. And if you're looking at gas or electric appliance, you get even greater reduction, but those are also more expensive. So there's sort of a matrix. And so this chart here kind of gives you just a range of how much you could get in terms of reductions and number of stoves replaced. Funding priority could be given to serious non-attainments or those areas that are at risk of serious non-attainment. And what I mean by serious non-attainment is that's an area that has been unable to come into compliance with the federal standards within a required time is required to enact even more stringent requirements on wood stove use and industrial development or expansion. So basically, DEQ's experience to date with wood stove changeout shows that this is a multi-year effort requiring sustained funding. And the ongoing funding provides a level of continuity for communities to know that there will be a multi-year funding source to do changeouts and be part of the larger effort within the community to address wood smoke. So one of the final key recommendations is to increase awareness of the wood smoke, basically is to enhance education and outreach across the state. Increasing awareness of the wood smoke problem is an essential component to implementing effective reduction programs, because if residents basically don't understand why reducing wood smoke is important, then needed or existing locally based reduction programs could fail or severely be hindered. So to date, limited state and local resources have resulted in limited outreach, and with an additional staff person and a technology support, the state could develop a suite of tools and programs that local communities and residents could use to address their individual outreach and education needs. And this could be things like doing some educational videos in multiple languages to reach potentially underserved communities, expanding community social media presence with tweets and posts about wood burning, providing year-round education through informational billboards and radio spots and newspapers and television ads. And so these are all things that can be specifically tailored for each community. So, in conclusion, I provided a link to the Wood Smoke Report for any nighttime reading. And essentially, Oregon has had a long history of addressing wood smoke in the state, and attaining federal air quality standards would not have been possible without the state and local partnerships to tackle the wood smoke problem. DEQ and local communities continue to work together to develop community plans and strategies to reduce wood smoke levels, and these recommendations build upon past successes of state and local efforts and provide a targeted, coordinated approach to ramp up state local efforts to reduce wood stove smoke. And I would be happy to take any questions you might have.
Will you guys have either agency bills or policy option packages? I heard three money items.
So, Chair Edwards, it's a great question. We won't have any bills on this issue, and we're still waiting approval from the governor's office on what legislative concepts will go forward on behalf of agencies to be pre-session filed. But I can tell you in what we've submitted to the governor's office for their approval, we don't have any language or legislation around wood smoke. In the governor's recommended budget, there are no dollars specifically for wood smoke beyond what Rachel talked about, which is the $170,000 per biennium. I think that was really due to the fact that the governor's budget is a budget of austerity and limited resources available to meet many competing needs. And the focus from the governor's office, the direction that she particularly wants to go, is focusing on the implementation of the Cleaner Air Oregon health-based air toxics rule around industrial emissions.
Thank you. Chair, what's it?
Thank you, Chair Edwards. Mr. Cotter, you mentioned about 150,000 wood stoves that need to be changed out. The cost that I've experienced changing out wood stoves runs between $1,500 and $2,000 to, but by the time you've bought the product and got the permitting and the labor and so forth. That figures out to be somewhere between $225 and $300 million.
So
where do you suppose we're going to come up with a quarter of a billion dollars to do this?
So, Chair Edwards, Senator Witz, it's a great question, and it's something that the work group grappled with, too, because we recognize that if we wanted to change out every single stove in the state, it would cost, as you mentioned, I think it was more around $750 million, because we estimated it cost, just based on previous experience, between $3,000 to $5,000 for a wood stove change out, just because when you factor in the cost of the actual wood stove plus the installation of it, because that can often be about the same as the price of a wood stove, it gets pretty expensive. But I think the reason why we looked at the work group recommended $3 to $5 million, we want to be able to sort of help target the communities that are most in need. So, for example, Oak Ridge and Klamath Falls, two areas that are designated non-attainment, we definitely want to be able to bring those levels down as quickly as possible. But we also wanted to have this sort of sustained funding so then other communities could also, you know, work at getting some of the funding and also get matching grants as well. Because if they know that they have, say, for example, $1 million coming from the state, maybe they could look through other private entities to get additional funding and so to kind of help work at it. It'll be great to replace every single stove, but I think we're trying to figure out the best coordinated way to do it. And we also have other programs in place to get those old stoves out. For example, we have the existing state Heat Smart program, which requires the removal of an uncertified stove at the time of home sale. So that's another way that we're hoping to get the old stoves out.
Well, it does shift the cost to the property owner. Another question. How many air quality monitors do you have in each of the following: Klamath Falls, Burns, Prineville, Oak Ridge, and Buckview?
All right. So, Senator Edwards, Chair Edwards, Senator Whitsitt. Let's see here. So you asked how many monitors are in each of the communities?
In each city.
So within Klamath Falls, there's one monitor in, I think you mentioned Burns as well. So there's one monitor there, and Prineville is another community, so there's one there. And I'm sorry, I can't remember the other communities that
Lakeview,
you mentioned.
Lakeview,
each Lakeview, so they each have one as well.
Point being, you model the area that is supposedly air quality impaired from this one point source. It's been a long time since I've taken a math course, but the last math course I took, you can draw a line in any direction from a single point. So I could question, and Palmer, I've asked you this repeatedly, what is your statistical confidence in your ability to say this area and with inside of this marks a lot area is actually air impaired when you only have one monitoring station?
So, Chair Edwards, Senator Whitsitt, when we place a monitor in an area, we usually do sort of what we call a monitoring survey. So we actually place a number of monitors in throughout the community and sort of measure air quality, and then we determine where's the best place to put it. So typically...
The one in Klamath Falls has been in the same place for since I was in knee pants, practically. That's been forever. And there's also a second air quality monitor out at the Air National Guard at Kingsley Field, which is my understanding doesn't have the same anywhere near the same figures yours does. Again, I come back to what's your statistical confidence in imposing $300 million of cost on a community?
Right.
If I may, Chair Edwards, Senator Whitsitt. So maybe we weren't very clear. It wasn't our intent in this recommendation to per se pose cost on homeowners or landlords who might rent out units that require wood stoves.
If a rental property changes hands, isn't it required to update it to a
right, and that's an existing statute that has been around since
2009, and it only requires removal of an uncertified stove. It actually doesn't require the homeowner to replace it unless they want to.
So these recommendations, though, were aimed at enhancing a state-local partnership, so the locals weren't left sort of totally bearing the cost to replace older stoves. It was to try to do that,
I applaud that effort. But we're probably only covering maybe 5% of the cost, and that's just the end of it.
Well, I think those details could be worked out in the program about how much of the costs get worked out in assisting a homeowner with replacing an older stove. The point about the monitor, I hear what you're saying, Senator Whitsitt. Certainly more monitors would give you a greater confidence in the data that comes that you collect. I certainly respect the point you're making. But it is helpful to talk about the role of that particular monitor and why there's a single monitor. That monitor, and I know you've heard me say this before, but I have to say it for the record, that single monitor is there because that's the federal requirements. That's the federal guidelines. It's a reference monitor. And they ask, and rather they direct the department to go and look for the place where there's the greatest health risk. And we do the saturation monitoring, the survey monitoring that Rachel's talking about, and that is why we place the monitor where we do. And it is simply, it's the thermometer in the air, as it were, to measure the worst risk in a given community. And that's what EPA uses to determine attainment, non-attainment, those sorts of things. So we are operating pursuant to federal guidance about the use of a single monitor and placing it in that way.
Senator Przanski.
Thank you. Rachel and Palmer, I know there's other people here. I know the mayor of Oak Ridge is here. I just wonder if you want to recognize some of the people that have been part of the work group. I know I've had the opportunity to sit in a couple of the meetings, and I think it's very important to recognize those in the communities that are adversely impacted.
Definitely.
Okay. Thank you both for your testimony and presentation. There will be more to discuss during the legislative session, and we need to move on with the agenda. So thank you. Okay, next up we have program review for water quality permitting. Colleen Johnson, Richard Whitman, Keith Anderson.
Good afternoon, Chair Edwards, members of the committee. For the record, Richard Whitman, Interim Director of the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality. I want to introduce the other members of the panel I have with me here today to give you a report on a consultant report on the status of Oregon's wastewater permitting system. First of all, to my left, I have Commissioner Colleen Johnson, who serves on the Environmental Quality Commission, former mayor of the city of LeGrand. And then to her left, I have Keith Johnson, who is the regional administrator for the Western region of the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality, currently on special assignment on this particular subject to be the point person in the agency for organizing our efforts to implement our response to this report. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'm going to go ahead and turn it over to Commissioner Johnson, then it's going to come back to me briefly, and then to Mr. Anderson.
Good afternoon, Senator Edwards, members of the committee. I'm here mainly today to really underscore how important this issue is and the consultant report that if you don't have now, you will shortly, the final draft. I first learned about the backlog, the water quality permitting backlog, shortly after I joined the commission. And I have to say my first thought was that it just doesn't make sense why we would have nearly 70% of the NPDES permits that are expired. I have been to, I think, most, if not all, of the meetings that have been around for this consultant report, including stakeholder meetings and staff reports. And what I have come to see in this rather long, at times tedious process, is how complicated this issue is. One facet of this issue is that DEQ should just write the permits. That's our job, to write permits that will satisfy the Clean Water Act, and of course, that's correct. We have an obligation, both a legal obligation, but also a moral obligation, to write those permits as necessary. The other issue, though, that as a local official and as part of my background that I see is how difficult it is to impose some of these costs on small, in particular, rural communities who simply don't have the financial resources to put in place millions, in some cases tens of millions of dollars of infrastructure improvements. And it's not just the financial resources, it's also the expertise that is necessary for this. And then finally, the other issue to just mention, which the report also talks about, is the resource issue, how DEQ is funded, what the organizational structure is, and how we resolve this issue so that everybody and all these problems can be resolved to the satisfaction of all parties involved. And I think the importance, obviously, is underscored by the fact that we did get money to do this consultation, and also I think DEQ has stepped forward with appointing one person in particular to sort of focus on resolving this issue. So thank you for your time.
So, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, before we go to Mr. Anderson to walk you through the report, I just want to give a couple of high-level remarks to frame this. And the first thing I want to talk about is why should care about this issue? And there are three reasons why the legislature in particular should care about this issue. First of all, from the environmental perspective, to the extent we are not keeping these permits up to date and we're letting them just go on renewal, it means that those permittees are operating in a way that does not meet current water quality standards. They're not being updated to meet changes in Oregon's water quality standards. That's problem number one, first reason you should care. The second reason is from the local government and industry perspective, to the extent you have permits that are being renewed without being updated, that is creating an increasing level of uncertainty in communities around the state about what their ultimate obligations are going to be to meet water quality standards, and is creating a context where it is difficult for communities to plan about needed infrastructure investment to keep their communities healthy and growing. And the third point is from an economic development perspective. To the extent we have basins where permits are being just administratively extended and not updated. That makes it very difficult for new sources, new industry that's coming into those regions to get wastewater permits. So it's an economic development issue as well. And that's briefly why you should care about this issue. It's not going to get solved overnight. It's going to take close coordination between the state and local government and industry to make this work. It's going to be a multi-year effort, and I'm so glad that Mr. Anderson is taking the point on getting us going. Keith?
Thank you. Chair Edwards, Senators, my name is Keith Anderson. I'm the Western Region Administrator. As Director Whitman pointed out, I'm on a special assignment right now working specifically on this this particular project. Commissioner Johnson briefly recapped the budget note. I wanted to point out that an actual link to the budget note itself is in your materials if you're interested in seeing that. I wanted to put a little context on today's conversation. This is our NPDES universe. That's the federally delegated permitting program that we're talking about today. The work that the consultants did is specific to those two small wedges up at the top. The balance of our NPDES world is our general permits. We have stormwater permits for industrial activities and for construction, and then we have other general NPDES permits that are for a variety of things like wash water or log ponds. The specific area that we're addressing today is our individual permits. Those are usually the bigger sources and more complex sources. In terms of the individual permits we're talking about today, we have a number of different kinds of permits. They're all federally delegated permits. The municipal storm sewer permits, that's for large urbanized areas and stormwater that emanates from those. Our domestic major permits are related specifically to larger communities. Portland would be an example, Hermiston and Cottage Grove are actually qualify as major individual NPDES permits. Our minors would include smaller communities. Minor domestic would include places like Coquille, Chiloquin, and Glendale. Then our industrial sources, major industrial sources would be like the Cascade Pacific Pulp Facility in Halsey. Individual industrial miners would include Boise Cascades, Medford Plywood Mill, and the Covanta Burner here right up the road. It's a combination. For domestics, it's primarily related to flow. For industrials, it's a combination of what kind of industry and what is the flow. So the consultant's report project started earlier this year. It's been through a number of phases in the intervening months. We had quite a spectrum of folks that were involved in providing input to the report. There's a number of folks in the room who were participants in that. The initial findings were delivered in September. They had quite a number of findings and recommendations. The stakeholder engagement has been present at each step of the project. I had a note in here that the draft final implementation plan, the final piece of this, was delivered November 23rd. We actually have a final report that came in late last week, and I spoke with Palmer Mason, and we're going to provide the committee with a link to that final report shortly after we're done here. Director Whitman highlighted the consequences of our permit backlog, so I won't go into that at all. The consultants did identify some, really key issues for us when they went through the report. One of the key issues that was identified was the lack of clarity for our permit writers' roles. Our permit writers do quite a number of things. They write permits. They do compliance activities. They take enforcement actions. One of the big things we do is provide community assistance, technical assistance, work with communities to help them understand, how to be in compliance, and then also strategize for ways to move forward in their particular community. Another issue was identified was lack of clarity in decision making. We do have a matrix organization, so we have three regional administrators, like myself, We have a headquarters administrator, and we have decisions that run sort of across all of those entities. Another item that was identified was coordination between planning activities and the permitting activities. And by planning, we're talking about standards development, water quality standards that inform our permits, and TMDL developments, which are ways to look at impaired water bodies and identify how to bring those back into compliance with water quality standards. We haven't always done a great job of lining up the standards in TMDL program with easily implementable permits or permits that can be written in a way that are easily understood. And then last part, difficulty of meeting standards for some communities requiring complex and frequently expensive engineering and regulatory solutions. I wanted to highlight one example is the city of Coos Bay. We've been engaged with the city of Coos Bay for a number of years in trying to get to a plan to move forward with a wastewater treatment plant that would meet our current requirements. To illustrate the change over time, one of the key issues we deal with in wastewater permitting is related to bacterial pollutants in the effluent. And one of the ways that we've done historically to mitigate that is chlorination to disinfect the effluent. So one of my permit writers mentioned that, you know, historically it was the key for us was to make sure there's enough chlorine residual in the effluent to really do that job. Well, as we became aware of chlorine's actual toxicity in the environment, we actually have to go the other direction and look at adequate disinfection followed by adequate dechlorination. So that's one of the things that Coos Bay is working on now. Another thing that's come up in that interim is ammonia toxicity. And ammonia toxicity is something that's dealt with by a completely different treatment train than historic, and certainly in this case, Coos Bay's plant. So there's an example of the kind of issues that were identified in the report development. Key takeaways for us, I think as you've already heard, they did a very comprehensive job. They covered a lot of ground and looked at a lot of different stakeholder groups in trying to, including DEQ staff, including cities, organizations, et cetera. And you've heard Director Whitman and Commissioner Johnson say we're committed to implementing this, the recommendations and the actions that are found there. The problems are complex, and the solutions are going to require a lot of work to collaborate. But this is a top priority for agency, as Director Whitman and Commissioner Johnson have both pointed out. In terms of the specific recommendations that came out of the consultant's report, really clarifying our staff's roles, you know, who's doing what. Clarify the responsibilities for decision-making and permits. You know, the objective outlined in the report is centralizing permitting authority. And we are looking at ways that that can be done. I know that Senator Dimbrough had a specific question at one point for Palmer about whether or not we'd lose that regional connection for permit writers. And we haven't made any decisions. You know, the decision that we do have is that we need to get to a you know, sort of a single chain of command on decisions relating to permits. And we think we have some ways that will continue that regional permitting presence. The idea could be a central permitting manager with regional permit writers reporting to that person. So we're looking at a bunch of different ways we could approach that, but we really do understand the value of having that regional presence and regional connection with our permit writers. One of the other recommendations has to do with our data. You know, we are a data-driven agency, and we need data, good data, to be able to write good permits. We have vast amounts of data right now. Unfortunately, it's not always easy to get to. So finding ways to improve our data management is a key recommendation. We've talked about the necessity to integrate work with the planning side of the water quality program in terms of our TMDLs and standards. And one of the things that we've already been discussing is really focusing our permit writers on writing permits only, not have that the other responsibilities that they are currently involved in. And then finally, improve accountability and transparency. Moving forward, we have a number of internal process improvements underway right now. One of the key issues relates to data. Another is making sure that our process is as streamlined as we can make it, as efficient as we can make it. One of the big recommendations from the report had to do with understanding our permit universe better. So really actually cataloging all of our individual permits in a way that we understand what their current plant design is, how they're currently operating, what the capacity of the plant is now, and is there future, you know, capacity enhancement available. But even probably more importantly, in terms of being able to write good permits and work on this, you know, better integration with the planning side of the program, understanding the regulatory environment that is there for each of those particular communities or each of those permittees. The other key piece is having some sense of the community capacity to respond to a new permit in terms of being able to meet new effluent requirements. We also recognize that the stakeholder groups that we've been working with are going to continue to be important. The consultants, based on feedback from the conversations they had around the stakeholder world, suggested that we recommended that we sunset the Blue Ribbon Committee. We had feedback from the committee members that indicated they weren't sure that we had the right the right charter in place for really solving problems going forward. So looking at how do we make sure we keep those important links there, maybe in a reconstituted way, considering some different groups, maybe focused on the community capacity piece, focusing on integration. And of course, we're going to have to continue to engage with a variety of folks, including you here at this table. That concludes our presentation. Are there any questions?
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Yep, Senator Denver.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. So in terms of DEQ's capacity and the resources that are needed, Commissioner, you mentioned that, what is the need in order to get us to catch up on the backlog? I mean, I think we all would like to see the backlog go away as a first step, and then where do we go from there moving forward? So what would it take if we wanted to solve this problem, catch up on the permits within the next year? What would it take?
Chair Edwards, Senator Dembro, I'm going to answer your question in two ways. First of all, in terms of DEQ resources that are needed to address this issue, Governor Brown does have in her governor's recommended budget a modest amount of money for implementing some of the recommendations of the task force. The task force implementation plan does call for bringing on consultant assistance to assist in working through the backlog and ramping up to a point where we are keeping up with the annual pace of permit renewals. But I think it's likely that the resources that are needed in DEQ are a combination of some internal organizational changes that are required in the agency to be more efficient in getting permits out the door. And in my estimation, that's almost more important than additional dollars, I think. But I think some additional dollars are going to be needed as well. And then the more important point is resources at the local level. In order to really make this system work, it is a partnership between the state and local government on the overall system. And our local cities, counties, industries who are the NPDES permittees, many of them are facing their own resource challenges, and that is part of the reason for the backlog. And so thinking about a coordinated effort both at the agency level and at the same time at the local government level to help local governments be prepared to actually act on these permits is the way we're going to get to a solution. There are some dollars also in the governor's recommended budget, bond funding for local wastewater that could be an important part of this as well.
Just to follow up. So bonding might be a source for the locals. What else? I mean, what do you propose for them? I mean, in if we're talking about industrial users, perhaps there could be some kind of temporary surcharge or something along those lines. But it sounds like for most cities, that's not going to be an option. Is that fair to say, or is that...
Chair Edwards, Senator Dembro, in terms of how we finance the resources that are needed to do this, bond finance will work, obviously, where we've got a capital projects involved in is part of the work that's needed. It's really in the area of technical assistance consultants for local governments in terms of putting together plans for how to meet their permits, where I think the resource need is the greatest. And there, you know, we have some local assistance programs currently in the state, but this is probably part of a broader discussion about how to fund infrastructure planning at the local level as we go forward. And that's probably above my pay grade to opine on that at this point.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay. Thank you all for being here. We're going to move on to the next panel. We're running a few minutes behind, so that's a hint to future panels to not take more time than is slotted. So, Task Force on Drought Emergency Response report is actually, hold on a second. I don't see if Representative Helm is here. I do not see Representative Helm.
I don't see Raquel.
And I don't see Raquel either. So we will come back to them. Is Kathy Dello here? All right.
Oh, there's Helm.
Oh, wait. Hold on. You know what? You may be off the hook. Sorry, Kathy. I think Representative Helm is here, and so is Raquel. So why don't you guys come up and
give your slot away.
And Kathy, you can breathe a sigh of relief that you're not up before you're ready to be up. I know what that's like to be anticipating testimony and then get called out of order. Okay, so you guys are here to present information for the Task Force on Drought Emergency Response. Take it away.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm just going to do some intros and make and give some thanks real quick and then head back over to the real fun and House Revenue, which is going on parallel to your meeting here. The thanks I want to give is to Raquel and Linnea.
ID yourself, too.
I'm sorry. It's the first time I've done this in a long time. So Ken Helm, State Representative, District 34. I wanted to publicly thank Raquel and Linnea from Oregon Water Resources Department for doing the compiling of this report. And over the course of, I think, was 6 months or so and 7 meetings, taking disparate ideas, abundant ideas on how we respond to drought, and sifting through them and making those ideas readable and understandable as recommendations to both the Senate and the House. I also wanted to commend all the stakeholders that participated. The appointees to this task force, A, showed up, B, were constructive, and they really put thought into the types of recommendations that they could agree to and the ones that they couldn't. One of the good decisions that they made early on was that regardless of whether an idea or a concept made it into the final draft as a recommendation, we would catalog all ideas in the back of the report in the appendix. And so therefore, the idea there was that no idea would be left behind just because we couldn't get full agreement, or we didn't have time, or perhaps in this context, the proposal or idea had more to do with long-term water management, especially water quantity management. So as we move in beyond reading this this document, it's worth remembering that there are a lot of good ideas in the back that we just didn't have time to fully flesh out. And with that, I'll hand it over to Raquel and go back to my other meeting.
Thank you.
Chair Edwards, members of the committee, Raquel Rancier, Senior Policy Coordinator with the Oregon Water Resources Department. I'm presenting this presentation today on behalf of the task force. I'll note that the task force membership included both appointees by the legislature as well as appointments made by the governor. And you can see those up on the screen here as well as in the executive summary and in the report. I've been asked to try to get through this in 15 minutes. There's 13 recommendations, so I will be quick on some of them, particularly those that are looking at administrative actions. Just as a reminder on what the direction was on the task force, it really was a task force that was looking at how we can prepare for and respond to drought. And you can see here there was three of six, there will be three on the next slide, that provide guidance on what the task force should look at, including looking at the sufficiency of existing tools as well as opportunities to minimize the impacts of drought, and looking at tools for assisting small water systems, and also looking at data and resources that are needed to anticipate drought, and then finally information sharing, so ways to increase information sharing with the public. Just a few caveats here to note. We did have limited time. The task force did meet, as noted by Representative Helm. They met from July to October, a total of seven times. As a result of that, and they did start out with 40 to 50 plus ideas. Those ideas are captured in Appendix D of the report if they did not move forward. There was at least seven of the members needed to vote in support of a recommendation. I think we got close, a lot higher than that on most of the recommendations except for one. The votes are recorded in the task force report if you're curious what they were. And because we had such a short amount of time, the recommendations were not prioritized, and I feel it's important to note that task force had noted to me that their priorities may change as they found out more about what the budget looked like. So a lot of these recommendations are around resources. There's a couple that would require legislation, and then there's some that are administrative actions. So because the task force did have 13 recommendations, we have a short time here today. I also want to flag for you that the votes are recorded in the report, but there's also more detail in implementation actions that are also in that report. And finally, I'll just note that I was staff. I was not a member of the task force, so I, again, am here trying to present this information on behalf of the task force. So with that, moving into the recommendations, the first one is around data and the need for additional data in order to be able to anticipate drought and really to provide information for municipalities, agriculture, businesses to be able to anticipate a drought. Some of the action items that were highlighted in the report is one that the agency should continue to work with communities to identify data gaps. Funding is necessary for data collection, instruments and associated staff to process that data. And then we also flagged something at the federal level, which was around the state advocating for federal funding for snow surveys. So that one was quite specific. Again, more details are outlined in the report under the implementation section. The next recommendation is around risk assessments and vulnerabilities and impacts. This is really out of a recognition that the best practices from drought literature say that, one, you need the data to be able to provide early warning, but two, you then need to assess where there's vulnerable systems, as well as what the previous drought, where those impacts were, so that you can, one, try to mitigate those actions, prevent them from happening in the future. And if you can't mitigate them, then you can at least know areas where you might need to target response actions. Other states have provided funding for that, and so this, again, is a flag around the need for funding for that. In addition, if those assessments are conducted, it can help local communities through their local hazard mitigation plans, as well as to help them leverage federal funding. The next recommendation is more of an administrative one around our drought declaration process and reviewing our tools. So I won't go into much depth on that one. There is quite a bit of detail in the report if you look at the implementation actions. Recommendation D is around establishing a drought emergency fund. One thing that other states have is a fund to be able to actually respond to drought while you're in that drought. And so the task force had made a recommendation that the legislature should consider establishing a fund that could address both needs for small water systems that may arise, as well as in-stream needs, and finally for agriculture. So some other states do have those kinds of programs. Recommendation E is around outreach and communication. This one was talked about quite a bit. If you look in the appendices, there's actually some detailed information. I think it's in Appendix C, if I remember correctly, around what the state could do if we had someone that was working on outreach. We don't currently have staff to do this kind of work, so we believe that there is a it kind of hampers the ability to educate the public and water users around what tools are available to them, as well as opportunities to help small water systems develop toolkits in order to have an easier way to do communication and outreach. So this one, there's quite a bit of detail around here, and we spent a lot of time talking about it, but essentially this would be another opportunity to improve understanding and utilization of the existing and regular drought response tools and water rate management tools. The next one, recommendation F, is around funding for drought planning. So again, the literature shows that if you can plan for it in advance, then you can take appropriate actions to try to mitigate the impacts of drought, and that's likely more frequently successful than trying to act in the moment to respond to drought. Again, though, it will also help you understand where you may need to target resources. This one includes providing potentially match funds for existing federal programs, such as the Water Smart Drought Contingency Plans, funds for small water systems to conduct planning, and then finally funding to incentivize the development of water management and conservation plans for irrigation districts. Recommendation G, this one's mostly around funding, and it's funding for field staff and specifically to also fund if the department identifies some opportunities for making water distribution more efficient. Recommendation H, this one really recognizes a topic that was a key conversation in many of the task force's meetings, and that was really around the lack of resources that small water systems have for planning, funding, technical assistance. So this outlines a number of recommendations within there that could help these small water systems potentially be more prepared to deal with and respond to drought. Recommendation I takes that a step further and also identifies that it may be helpful to provide or for a group of experts to actually review the existing funding programs that are out there, outline what the requirements are, and then also to identify what the barriers are to accessing those programs. The second component of this recommendation is then around these smaller water systems or individuals. It can be a challenge for them to identify what funding programs they might be eligible for, or for them to put together a competitive application. So this again here highlights that a need for technical assistance
could be helpful for those that need to address these infrastructure needs, particularly since we have backlogs in some of these areas. Recommendation J. This one is mostly administrative in nature in terms of the implementation actions, and essentially suggests that there may be a need for modified storage management practices in dry years so that we can maintain flood control while also providing storage later in the year. And so again, this one is about evaluating those potential management options for stored water. Recommendation K, this one is around water conservation and efficiency, and improving or promoting, I guess, water conservation and efficiency. Some examples that were highlighted in the task force report are potentially tax incentives for water conservation efficiency measures, or making water rebates non-taxable income. A few members of the task force had noted that other states have done this, but that Oregon was not one of those states that had incentives in place for such actions. We're almost there. So recommendation L. This one is, again, a recommendation around considering additional programs for increasing voluntary stream flow restoration during times of drought. There was a lot of discussion around this idea and a number of options that were laid out. Ultimately, the only one that did move forward was looking at the pre-approval of leases. So the concept being that an individual could come to the department, apply for an in-stream lease, and it would be good for up to 5 years, which is consistent with our typical in-stream leasing program. But then they could decide whether or not each year, and at the beginning of the irrigation season, whether that water was going to be used on their property or whether it was going to be put in stream. So that was one idea that was proposed in the task force. And then the final recommendation is that Oregon should continue to encourage water reuse. So with that, hopefully I got through those in a speedy enough time, and I'm happy to take any questions.
Questions by committee members? Raquel?
General, what's it? Thank you, Chair Edwards. Mr. Van Seer, when we're dealing with drought, there's two ways to address it. One is to store more water, and one is to use less water. And I looked through your presentation, and I looked through this entire report, and I really couldn't find any conversation about storing more water, save in the Appendix D, where apparently it provided greater funding prioritization of storage projects that address drought and or critical water shortages, didn't have enough votes to get out of whatever. It's disappointing because we've discussed many times that our Oregon's primary source of primary facility for storing water is our snowpack. And if we really believe that global warming is going to change that, or global climate change is going to change that, then how could we not develop a different form of storage? And yet this entire drought discussion apparently didn't go there.
Chair Edwards and Senator Whitsett, I don't want to speak on behalf of the task force on that question, but what I can say is that I think that we, given the short amount of time that we had, we were trying to focus on shorter term actions, not that didn't happen across the board, but that we'd also flag that the Integrated Water Resources Strategy, so the statewide water strategy, one of the recommended actions in that strategy does include that the state should encourage additional storage. So we do have that. We're already working on that action. We have our funding programs. So there's the Water Project Grants and Loans Program that can fund storage, among other water projects. And so I think, given the limited time frame, the task force focused primarily on those actions that perhaps we didn't already have recommendations elsewhere.
Just a comment. I don't, if the state of Oregon has helped fund any new water storage in the last 10 years. I missed it. I know the funding is out there, but actually has funded any project. I've missed it. But then we come to your recommendation, J, evaluate management options for stored water to better address current and future in-stream and out-of-stream needs. That appears to me to be not only we're not going to store more water, we're going to perhaps recommend that we reallocate water that's currently stored for irrigation for other purposes during drought. Is that roughly right?
Chair Edwards and Senator Whitsett, I'd have to go for, I think there was two questions there. So in regards to whether we've provided funding, I'd have to go back and look, and I'm happy to get this information to you. I believe we had at least one storage project that applied for the Senate Bill 839 Water Project Grants and Loans, the first ever we've had. So we made a decision on that earlier this year. I believe it was to raise a dam, an existing dam, but I think that there was a project funded there. So I'm happy to get that information to you. And then on the second one, the context of the conversation around evaluating these management options is, I think, actually with the goal of providing more water for late summer. With the poster child really being, I think, the Willamette Basin. And if you drove over the Willamette Pass in 2015, you probably noted that those reservoirs were low. And so a lot of the conversation actually got at what's the water control diagram that, for example, the Corps is using, what's the flexibility within that. And if you look at the other two implementation actions, they're really around what flexibility does state law currently have around spill and fill, for example. And so how can we better utilize that those storage projects, those ones that are for flood control, for example, can we utilize those so that they can still provide that same level of flood protection at the same time being able to store more water later in the season? So that was the context around that particular conversation.
So it wasn't didn't involve the reallocation of water that's stored for irrigation to other purposes like we've been doing in the Klamath Basin?
Chair Edwards, Senator Whitsett, no, we didn't have that conversation that at least I recall.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks, Ms. Chair. So Raquel, are there concrete proposals that are coming out of this in terms of legislative proposals for this session?
Chair Edwards, Senator Dumbro, I'm glad that you asked that question. As I noted previously, we were on quite the expedited schedule, so there wasn't a prioritization. However, the department has a placeholder bill that I expect will likely be filed, and it is relating to drought, so it's clearly intended in the event that any of the proposals, so if any legislators are interested in the proposals or the stakeholders, that we have that vehicle to be able to carry those forward. We're now in the process of talking with stakeholders. I'd certainly love to hear your feedback if there's any proposals that you are interested in, but we do have that as a vehicle for the session. Presuming it gets filed.
Thank you, Raquel.
Thank you.
Okay. The next presentation we are going to have is the Oregon Climate Assessment. Kathy Dello from the Oregon Climate Change Research Institute.
Great. Thank you, Chair Edwards, members of the committee. My name is Kathy Dello. I'm the Associate Director of the Oregon Climate Change Research Institute. And I'm here to update you on our 2017 assessment report. We had hoped that it would be out by now, but the lead staffer on it asked us for a few more months to work on it. So it'll be out in January, but I just wanted to give you a sneak preview of some of the findings. Here we go. And we're not here all that often, but I wanted to give you a quick update on OCRI itself. We were established about a decade ago in the 2007 session of the legislature. We're now up to 14 staff and students, and we've funded 80 collaborators through these large interdisciplinary proposals. Many of these collaborators are in Oregon at the Oregon universities. We're also home of the State Climate Office, which is under my purview. And the federal government has funded two large climate centers that are housed at OSU in our institute. And mostly we focus on adaptation, and drought is a big focus of both of those. And in our legislation, we are asked to produce an assessment of the science periodically. So this will be our third one. And I want to note that this is drawn from the peer-reviewed literature. So this isn't stuff that we just come up with on our own. We're coming through all the journals, all the articles, of which there are many, and finding all the key findings for Oregon. The thing is, when you write these reports, you start saying the same things over and over and over. The 2010 report was our first, and it was 435 pages. And I can assure you, I'm probably the only person who read all 435 because I led that report. We followed up with a slightly shorter report in 2013. It was about 200 pages. And this time we're aiming for about 100 pages. We don't want to keep repeating ourselves. But after 3 years, we found that there are a bunch of relevant papers and findings that we should be including in this report. So it's building off the past two, but it does have some updates that are important. And what our institute does is that instead of looking at this every 3 years, every month or every 2 months now, all of us on the staff have a journal that we're assigned to. We have to read the papers, pull them out, and we condense them and write them up for a newsletter. So we're assessing the literature as time goes on. But since those of us who work in climate tend to think in sectors and Oregonians look to where they live, we're going to write up one-page regional summaries this time. And I'm not going to bury the lead. These are key draft findings. And like I said, we keep repeating ourselves when we write these reports, but these read very similar to the last key findings that we put out. And you'll hear in the news at the end of this month that 2016 is going to be the warmest year on record globally. But global climate change impacts actual Oregonians. It's not happening in third world countries only on the Gulf Coast. It's happening here in Oregon. And especially vulnerable populations are going to be hurt the most. Our rural populations, our people of lower socioeconomic status, women, elderly, pregnant people, certainly because of health risks, but also less diverse economies. Oregon's warming. And one of the brand new findings that we can say is that we can now attribute some of our regional trends to human activity. So for a while, science wasn't able to pinpoint the greenhouse gas contribution to some of these smaller events. But what we're able to do now is find the fingerprints of climate change on our regional trends and some of our recent events like the 2015 drought. And Raquel just briefed you about drought. Declining mountain snowpack is our most important reservoir, and it will have significant impacts to our water resources as it's declining. We're seeing a great deal of increased coastal flooding and erosion. We expect that sea level rise on top of that will make matters worse on the Oregon coast. And the next bullet is basically just a way of saying that the climatic suitability, or what our forests live in now, will be hurt by disturbances. So we may see more insects and diseases move into the state. We've also seen wildfires increase. We've had big wildfires in the past few years. Plus, a warmer climate may make our forests look dramatically different by the end of the century. And we have to talk about some of the positives. There will be short-term gains for agriculture. We are seeing a longer growing season. The plants like a little bit warmer weather and the CO2. But the CO2 makes the plants of lower quality. And we start to see in the long term, we lose those gains. And we find that we may not have the water for agriculture. And that's another conversation. But also that the plants may not be adapted to the heat. And the recent climate events that we've seen, the 2015 drought, the blob out in the ocean, are really a practice run for our future. While climate change had its fingerprints on those, it's going to keep happening, and we now have a chance to practice for those. Just a little bit on the boring details of structure and content. We will give a two-page executive summary of basically those key findings with the citations attached to them. And we're just going to do a few chapters on climate, water, coasts, forests, agriculture, and health. And we chose these chapters in consultation with a few folks at the state, but also the 2014 National Climate Assessment. These were highlighted as key risks for the region. Again, we're going to add some regional summaries, and we're trying to cover tribal issues, social science, and economics in each of the chapters instead of making them their own. The timeline, we're in a rolling review period, so we have one staffer working on most of this, and we're sending out the chapters to selected expert reviewers. So this is an expert in the field of, say, water science or coastal geomorphology, and they're sending back the comments. She's incorporating all of those now before she leaves for winter break. In January 17, we'll deliver the final copy. And we had a small bad thing become an opportunity. Our website was hacked, but we are re-releasing it with summaries of the chapters, knowing that most people get their information on the internet. Just a few figures that I do want to show you, and these are draft, but they will be included in the report. We use climate models because we have one planet, and we're living on that planet, and we're performing an experiment on that planet. We can't be like other scientists where we build a maze and have a mouse run through it and then figure it out. So we have to build our planet somewhere else. So we build it in computers. We know a lot about how the atmosphere works, we know a lot about how the ocean works, and we know a lot about how they interact together. So there are 35 modeling centers around the world that have built these replications of Earth in these computers, and they start to think about what the future may look like. So in the gray, we have the gray band is what the models have simulated for Oregon's climate for the 20th century. The dark lines are the average of all the models, and the squiggly lines are the observations. So they do a pretty good job at seeing what's happened, which is a good test. Then going forward, we have to think about some things. I say we know how the planet works, but people are very difficult. And we have to give these models a few scenarios of how the globe may act. Certainly, Oregon's been a leader in reducing its greenhouse gas emissions, but our temperature is going to be determined by what happens globally. So the red area, our CP 8.5, is an emission scenario where we keep doing what we're doing now. The globe keeps using fossil fuels and emitting greenhouse gases the way it is. The yellow scenario, our CP 8.5, is a world where we adhere to something like our Paris targets. We start reducing our greenhouse gas emissions globally. And you can see the two scenarios diverge quite a bit. If you look, the mean for the lower scenario is about 4 degrees Fahrenheit change from the past, but the mean for the higher scenario is about 9 degrees Fahrenheit change from the past. One thing that I do want to point out on that top diagram is that the two scenarios don't diverge until about 2040. So we've already bought into a fair amount of warming, about 2 to 7 degrees by 2050. 3 or 4 degrees at the mid-range. So we need to think about adaptation. Beyond that, Oregon's temperature is going to be dictated by what happens globally, but there's still some time to get on that lower path. I don't want to spend a ton of time on the bottom panel. It's precipitation. Temperature is going to drive a lot of our impacts in the future, but our precipitation here is dominated by natural variability. We've got our El Niños and our La Niñas. We're in a La Niña now. And we have big wet years and dry years as well. And we don't expect that to change much in the future. Averaged out, that mean line is about 1% change from the past. So not much change in annual precipitation, but we do see some seasonal changes, maybe drier summers and wetter winters. So when we start to think about our water resources, like I said, temperature is going to be the thing that impacts us the most. I want to just focus on A and C, that's winter and summer. This is a change in mean seasonal runoff. So runoff for that entire season from about this year to mid-century with that RCP 8.5, that scenario where we keep doing what we're doing now. Anything in green is a higher percentage runoff, so in winter we're seeing either precipitation fall as rain that used to fall as snow and running off, or we're seeing snow melt earlier. In June through August, when your snow melts out early or you have rain falling instead of snow, you would have lower flows or lower runoff in the summer, which we're seeing in the mountains. In eastern Oregon, you see a change in runoff, an increase in runoff in almost every single season, and there are some indications that we may see some changing precipitation patterns out there. And often when we talk about sectors and changes to Oregon, we often go right to the natural resources, but there are assets that live in the coastal zone that will be impacted by sea level rise. There are people and homes and sewage plants and miles of road. And we see almost every year 101 underwater, and that scenario could be happening more and more in the future. This is just a nice little map from Climate Central. It's a group that we're going to use this in the report, showing the areas, Clatsop County, of course, being one of them, that have assets that are under 4 feet below mean high tide level. So again, just going back to the key findings, we do have a chance to think about our future, and we've made steps toward reducing our greenhouse gas emissions, but like I said, the two scenarios don't diverge all that much for the next few decades. So we need to think about resilience, and we need to think about building resilience in these areas. And if we think back to 2015, this was a scene that was common across the Pacific Northwest. It was certainly striking to many of us, not having snow at a ski resort in February in the Oregon Cascades. And unfortunately, this situation will be happening more often in a warmer Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you, Kathy. At the last Global Warming Commission meeting, I had a chance, or at least the last one I was at. I don't think there's been one since. Okay, I'm getting a head nod. Because I don't make every meeting. Some of these findings were presented, and when I heard it, I found them very interesting, and so that is one of the reasons why I invited you guys to come and share with us just a little preview. I understand that it's still under peer review. That's not completed yet, so the official report will be out in January. One of the particularly interesting pieces of information for me, and I still have a hard time wrapping my head around this, and so I've inquired with other people, but it seems to be true, is that you know, often when we talk about climate-related issues, I mean, of course, I've been very public about saying that I think we as a state need to do our part, but really, I think that the United States needs to do its part, and many people feel that China needs to really do their part first. And because China has more emissions. And I found it interesting in the report, and I don't know if it'll still be in there in January or not, but the total emissions and then the per capita emissions were highlighted. And per capita, the U.S. Was double the emissions of China. Oregon was cleaner than the U.S. average, but was still double the per capita emissions of China, which if you've spent some time in China, and I've spent a lot of time in China, and you look in the sky, you go, what the hell are they doing? I mean, it is so, the air pollution is, you know, it's tangible, you can see it, and it's not hard to wrap your head around the idea when you're there that human activity affects the air and also the climate. And so I have found that statistic fascinating, and I want to see more information about it to hear that on a per capita basis, because they have 1.4 billion people, they are cleaner from a greenhouse gas emissions perspective than the state of Oregon. You don't have to elaborate on that. I'm saying that out loud so that everybody else can hear it.
I agree. So.
Senator Whitsitt, you had your hand up.
Thank you. I draw your attention back to your model simulations about four slides back. perhaps I'm reading this wrong, but you're speculating that there'd be 1.8 to 6.9 degree Fahrenheit increase in temperatures by 2050. That's a 300% variable. And then you go down to the next one, you talk about precipitation goes from a minus 6% to a plus 11.4, which is a 300% variable. I'm wondering how you can draw conclusions off of that kind of, and actually the annual precipitation is not even original, it's an original model, it's adapted from another model. At least that's what the footnote says. So I'm wondering how you can draw conclusions off of something that disparate.
Chair Edwards, Senator Whitsitt, that's a good question. So there are 35 different models, and each is tuned a little bit differently, and each of them deals with the sensitivity of CO2 in the atmosphere a little bit differently. So what we're trying to do is bracket all the possibilities. So that 1.8 to 6.9 is the range of possible futures, but in reality, many of the models could converge on a much smaller range. Every single one of the models, every single one of those 35 models shows warming in Oregon through 2050. Not a single one shows cooling. And that's because we know the planet's warming and it's impacting us here as well. Precipitation, like I said, we're still dominated here by natural variability. Our spot on the globe, we're right in the bullseye of the storm track, which moves up and down and left and right because of El Nino and La Nina. And there is, you know, some evidence that maybe the extreme events are getting more extreme because of warmer atmosphere, but with annual precipitation, it's not like temperature. It's harder to pinpoint. But models are a guide. Like I said, we have one planet, and we can't have another planet and then do a bunch of experiments on it. So what we're doing is tuning these models. And they've been tuned now. This is the fifth round. And they've checked out. You can see that black squiggly line fits what we're saying. Does that answer your question?
Yeah. Senator Devereaux.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Kathy, I have a couple of questions. First, so the report is out for peer review now. What sorts of people are reviewing it?
Chair Edwards, Senator Devereaux. It's mostly faculty at the Oregon universities or universities nearby, so in Idaho or Washington. Each chapter went out to at least two people. Both myself and our director, Phil Moat, have all the chapters, so essentially it has four sets of eyes on each chapter. And then when we started out, we sent an extended outline out to a few people and said, are we missing any key papers from your field? So essentially it's gone through one mini review and now the full review.
And have you gotten feedback yet? And how is that treated when it comes to that?
Chair Edwards, Senator Devereaux, we have gotten feedback on a few of the chapters, and how it's treated is it's not like the IPCC where every single comment has to be cataloged and signed off on by a huge committee. But what we're doing is taking each comment seriously and going through it and deciding, is this something that we missed? Do we need to change this? Were we wrong? And there are certainly a few of those. There are some in just style. In a 100-page report, we have to cut some stuff. And if you study just forests, you may see something and think, hey, you really need to add this. So we're having back and forth on that. And then there are a few who would just, you know, maybe pursue things differently. And I would say that's the maybe 25% of the comments. And we are picking through those as well. So it is a lengthy process because you write this report and you have all these comments and then you try to factor everything back in while maintaining the integrity of the report.
Yeah, that makes sense. My second question is about, so you mentioned the coastal effects and, you know, erosion and flooding, but how about the effects of ocean warming and ocean acidification and the effects on our maritime, our fisheries, et cetera?
Chair Edwards, Senator Devereaux, that's a great question, and I left the coastal bullet kind of vague because I haven't seen the reviews from that chapter, and we are drawing from the West Coast panel on ocean acidification quite heavily, the findings from that, because OCRI in and of itself doesn't focus on that topic very much, so we're totally relying on other people who have worked on that. But the coastal projections, there was a West Coast sea level rise report which came out, I think, 4 years ago now, and there have been some updates. So we're trying to parse through what all the different sea level rise projections mean. But we haven't ignored ocean acidification, for sure. And then we've also introduced the blob as well, which is that area of warmer than normal sea surface temperatures, which wreaked all sorts of havoc. And then the West Coast algal bloom, which is exacerbated by climate, but necessarily isn't a climate impact. So it will be in there.
Great, thanks. General Olson.
Thank you. Could you explain how you establish the baseline temperature?
Chair Edwards, Senator Olson, the baseline temperature is established that this graph is showing 1970 to 1999. Sorry, I didn't explain that very well. So that's why you see the earlier years are a little bit cooler. Climatologists like to use at least a 30-year slice to establish any sort of baseline or representative temperature precipitation because there are year-to-year swings. 1970 to 1999 was used in this case because it's what was used in a number of other studies, so we want them to reflect each other.
In the 1970s, weren't they talking about they were worried about global cooling and an ice age?
Chair Edwards, Senator Olson, that was one article that showed up, I think, in Time magazine. Recently, I saw a newspaper article where they were talking about carbon dioxide emissions into the atmosphere 100 years ago and how we were going to need to worry about them. The overwhelming consensus from the 80s on has been the planet is warming. We know it's warming. It's not cooling. We certainly wish it weren't warming, but global cooling is not a possibility.
Is that a fact or is that an assumption?
Chair Edwards, Senator Olson, it's a fact. It's as much a fact as gravity. I can want gravity to not exist, but if I stand on this table and walk off, I'm going to fall. There's a preponderance of evidence that points to the planet warming. We have observations. We see the impacts across the landscape. We've seen wildfires increase. We've seen storms get worse. We've seen loss of snow and glaciers around the planet.
We've never seen that before.
Chair Edwards, Senator Olson, we've seen climate changes in the past, but never this abruptly. We're talking over a series of decades. Carbon dioxide right now is at the highest point that it's been in 800,000 years. We're living in this time period. This is where we are.
I'd like to follow up on that. I mean, for those of us who are old enough to remember the 70s, there was not just one article in Time magazine. There were multiple articles in peer-reviewed journals telling us that we were facing global winter and global starvation. So go back and look.
Any other questions, comments? Thank you for being here and taking the heat from this committee. I happen to stand with you and your position on this issue, but not everybody in the legislature does, and I know that it's not easy to come before this committee on these topics. Thank you.
Doug, you gotta chill.
Okay. Next up, preview of the Global Warming Commission biennial report. Angus Duncan, chair. You're on.
Mr. Chairman, Angus Duncan. I'm chairman of the Oregon Global Warming Commission, president of the Bonneville Environmental Foundation. Kathy and I do this buck and wing together a lot. You know, she's the setup artist, and then I have to come along and explain how we can avoid all of those nasty upward swings of her curves. So, Mr. Chairman, I'm going to walk you through what you should expect from our commission. We hope in at the end of next month, where we are trying to shift the delivery of our required biennial report, you know, from showing up in June when, you know, the legislature is all set to go home, to showing up in January where we might actually inform your policies to some extent. So I do want to walk through this, but I would be remiss if I did not begin by acknowledging the chair's professional transition, pending transition, in which we wish him well, but you know, we still deeply regret the absence of his knowledge and his commitment here in Salem in 2017. But we'll all dig in and try to make up for it. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Your wise and experienced staff took one look at my PowerPoints and said, you'll never get through all of those. So I'm not going to, in fact, there we go. So I am actually going to try to focus on 3, 4, and 6 here. And I will be going through some of the other slides fairly quickly. But I've given you all copies of the pack so that if you have questions, you can grab me as we go through. So,
and Angus, I don't want to give you too much leeway, but we're doing okay on time now. So.
That's very unwise, Mr. Chairman.
I said that.
That was really
you had to say that.
Oh, man.
Maybe you're not
this
as experienced
as I
thought.
This is my last act as chair.
Can we take a roll call?
There's no second on that, I don't think. Yeah.
I'm zipping through anyway. All right, I'm going to behave myself and hope for an invitation back someday. So those are the ones we're going to focus on. These are Oregon's historical emissions, the way we inventory them. They include all emissions that originate within the state of Oregon, plus all emissions associated with electricity generated outside of the state, but brought into the state and used here. So that's our historical inventory. We do it in a couple of other ways, but this is the one that we can keep track of.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
Before you get any further,
yes,
I guess
sorry,
you don't
sure.
mind. On 14 and 15, are those statistically correct numbers or are they assumed numbers?
Actually, I'm delighted you asked that question, Senator, because we have really worked hard with DEQ over the last 2 or 3 years to try to bring the data current and accurate. When we started working on this 10, 15 years ago, we had four-year-old data, and it's very hard for either you or us to make, you know, recommendations and decisions based on that. We now have our data and with for transportation and for utilities, they are reported data, so they're accurate. They are actual numbers. They're actual emissions that have been counted and measured. For agriculture, for forestry, you know, we still are using the 2 or 3 year old numbers, but those are relatively small parts of the overall emissions circle. Energy, transportation and utility energy make up about 80% of our greenhouse gas emissions. So we're trying to get our numbers to where we have them within a year of when, you know, of when they actually occur, and we can measure them and get them reported early in the next year.
Follow up?
Yeah, follow up.
I just want to be clear on this. For 2014-2015, DEQ has given me numbers that they're only preliminary, but you're assessing them as actual numbers.
So they may have given you a shorthand explanation. As I said, the two most significant emissions categories, transportation emissions and utility energy emissions, are actual numbers. The other emissions, let's see, there. So natural gas is reported. Industrial gas is reported, but other industrial emissions are not. For example, non-CO2 and non-methane emissions. Agriculture is I think 2 or 3 years out of date, but it doesn't change very much year to year. So what we've tried to do is to give you numbers that are as accurate as they can, but also timely. And in the case of approximately 80% of these numbers, these are actual measured emissions.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
just for the record, they've got a footnote 3 on 2014 and 2015 from DEQ, and it says preliminary data sets are subject to change. Please contact Oregon DEQ Greenhouse Gas Reporting Program for the latest information and for a full data set. I'm just stating that just recently I received these numbers and they're preliminary, and I just want to be clear that you know, do you have the actual things, because they don't.
Yeah.
Or at least they told me they don't.
So it is certainly true that any numbers are subject to revision. If it turns out, for example, that a company, you know, misrepresented or mis-submitted certain numbers, you know, so we can always go back and revise and revisit any of these numbers. But based on the way we compile the inventory, and particularly the energy numbers, and these are now reported electricity and gas numbers by utilities and by companies that actually use the energy. Those are reported to DEQ in 2015. You know, by the end of 2015, we have all those reported numbers. You know, during the first half of 2016, the staff worked really amazingly hard to try to get us numbers by the middle of 2016. They made, you know, actually made the fall of 2016, but next year we are going to aim for a six-month lag between the completion of the emissions year and the availability of those reported numbers.
Now, one last question, yeah. Mr. Chair. You had mentioned, I believe you did, I think I heard this correctly, you said that all greenhouse gas, greenhouse gas emissions in the state plus anything generated out of the state where power came into the state. Am I correct on that?
Where electricity came into the state. That's correct.
Does the states that where the electricity is generated at, do they also count those greenhouse gas emissions?
Now, some do and some don't, but both of the utilities that serve loads in the state, PacifiCorp and PGE, do count emissions at their plants or at plants that they're acquiring generation from out of state, and they report those emissions to the state of Oregon.
So do you, have you, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
So do these emissions that they report from out of state generation, do you ever delineate those to say that we do 40 million metric tons in state and 20 million metric tons out of state?
Yes, actually, because the emission, I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, because the emissions are plant specific, so that if, for example, PGE owns, I think they own 20% of Colstrip 3 and Colstrip 4, they will report the overall emissions of Colstrip, and then 20% of that will be attributed to Oregon loads and go into our inventory. Okay. But they're actually doing the measuring.
The question I asked was, do you ever delineate that this is what we actually produce in Oregon, and this is what's produced out of Oregon?
Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry.
Added on?
Yeah, so because those emissions... Because those emissions are plant-specific, you know, if we simply removed all of the reported emissions from out-of-state power plants, the balance would be in-state emissions.
Right, but do you ever do that to
sure.
show that?
Sure, yeah, that's easy to do. If you would like us to provide you with that information, I'd be happy to do so.
Would you please?
Sure.
Thank you.
Okay. So, Mr. Chairman, sorry, if I can... I'm not sure if I can go back, can I? Well, if I can't go back, I'll just keep going. Nah, never mind.
I hear she comes to make you go back.
No. No, that's okay. Let's just keep going forward. They saw that, and there's a particular aspect of that slide that I have to come back to anyway, but it's picked up by a subsequent slide. So that's approximately the spread of greenhouse gas emissions, and that includes CO2, methane, and the non-CO2 fluorocarbons and related greenhouse gases that are the six overall gases that EPA designates as greenhouse gases. And as you see, by far the largest chunks there are transportation and utilities. And of the electric utility, about a total of a wedge that's about 25% of the full circle is light-duty vehicles, cars and small trucks. About 25% of the electricity use, you know, as of today, is still coal generation. So we have tended to try to focus our attention on cars and on coal and see whether we can get the greatest cost-effective reductions in those two places initially. And there they are. Oh, well.
She's proceeding now.
Yeah. I'm all right. Back. Previous. Back. God bless it. Good. All right. They shouldn't let me loose with a machine like this. All right. Okay. All right.
You need an entourage.
I do. I need a couple of caddies to pick out my clubs for me, Mr. Chairman. So you all worked very hard on Senate Bill 1547. Last spring, so did a number of us, so did the two electric utilities. It was a pretty good piece of public policy work, I believe. And the outcome of that, at least for PacifiCorp, as you see, is that when we measure their emissions on a trajectory that would lead to a proportional share of the 2050 allowed greenhouse gas emissions under our state goals, PacifiCorp, while it's above the trajectory until 2030, at 2030, which is when they have committed to ending coal delivery of coal by wire to Oregon loads, their emissions drop dramatically down below that trajectory and then go roughly sideways going forward based on their current integrated resource plans. And I would, if we had the time, we would discuss whether, in fact, their emissions will probably go lower than that, because they almost certainly will, given where technologies are headed. But in any event, you can see that on balance, PacifiCorp will be in compliance with, or more than in compliance with, the state's greenhouse gas goals through at least 2050. PacifiCorp is a slightly different beast. And it's a different beast in part because it made a decision, also a negotiated one, to end coal combustion at the Boardman Power Plant by 2020. And so its emissions from 2020 for the next two or three years are below the trajectory. But if, in fact, they end up buying a gas plant instead of renewables, or predominantly relying on gas instead of predominantly on renewables, their emissions go significantly above the line until 2035, when their commitment to end deliveries from coal strip kicks in. And then their emissions go back down again to the line, but then immediately start moving sideways or upwards again. So there's a fair amount of work still to be done. We are working with Portland General Electric in their IRP process and with the Public Utility Commission to see whether there are cost-effective choices for them that could displace a commitment to a new baseload gas plant. And PGE is, I think, working very constructively in that process. We'll see where we end up.
I guess really quickly, are the two, since you highlighted both these investor-owned utilities, do they have the same goal? Flipping back and forth between the slides, they start at different places.
They start at different places.
So PacifiCorp is,
yes,
is more coal-intensive, mm-hmm, now, mm-hmm, but then goes to, is the goal different? That's what I'm wondering.
Yes. The answer is the goal is different. PacifiCorp's emissions go down to something a little over 2 million tons in 2050, and PGE goes down to just about 2 million tons. But they do start in different places, and because they have different compositions to their resource portfolio, they follow very different tracks to get to a 2050 goal. But the 2050 goal in both cases, I'm sorry, in the case of PacifiCorp, would be in compliance. The 2050 goal for PGE, at least based on its current IRP process, would not. But there's a lot of time between now and 2050, and you know, we expect to make it a lot easier for them.
Yeah. Senator, what's it?
Thank you, Mr. Weiss. That slide shows in a two-year period of roughly a 43 or 45% drop in emissions. The PacifiCorp was even more dramatic, as I figured, about a 67% drop in emissions in 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
So what assumptions do you make there? That when they stop using coal, as you said, are they going to shift over immediately to natural gas, or are you assuming this is going to be wind and solar?
So
currently, there's like 0.27% of electricity in Oregon is on both sides of the meter is being produced by solar and less than 2% by wind. So mm-hmm. How do you get that?
Sure.
What assumptions do you make?
Chair Edwards, Senator Whitsitt, you know, we are relying on the language you passed in Senate Bill 1547 and the Utilities Integrated Resource Planning. And essentially, the parameters that 1547 set are by 2035, neither utility is importing coal-generated electricity into Oregon, and all coal-generated electricity in Oregon has terminated. And under, also under 1547, both utilities are committed to meeting 50% of their load in 2040 from new renewable energy. So that's new wind, solar, potentially biomass and other technologies. And you actually can add to that, of course, a certain amount of base hydro, which is still in the both utilities' resource portfolios.
And that point is that's all, according to this graph, that's all going to occur in 2 years.
Two-year
windows, separate windows for each different utility. That's not realistic.
No. And, in fact, that's not going to happen. So what you're seeing in case of this line is, in effect, sort of the worst case as it's established by 1547, which says Pacific needs to end its coal deliveries to Oregon by 2030. And so there's a line there between 2029 and 2030 that says all of that coal generation ends in that year. As a practical matter, we expect Pacific to be ramping those coal facilities out between now and 2029 or 2030. And in fact, they have actually made commitments to two plants that are going to close down in the early 2020s, but are represented in this slide as not closing until 2030. Mm-hmm. So, yes.
One follow-up. Yeah. I would wonder, I mean, I assume that you're making assumptions that wind and solar are going to become a lot less expensive. But it would be interesting to see, using current cost of solar and wind, unsubsidized cost. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm not talking to the ratepayer, but to the ratepayer and taxpayer, everybody, the unsubsidized cost. It'd be interesting to see the similar what happens to the cost of electricity during that two-year window. Mm-hmm. But, you know, whether you shift entirely to natural gas or whether you shift to some different combinations of natural gas and renewables. But that's just not realistic. And if that did occur, I could see the cost factor going just the other direction.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Mr. Chair, Senator Whitsitt, if you shifted over today from new coal to new gas, then costs would go down. If you shifted from, you know, existing coal and existing gas to renewables, costs would go up. So, absolutely, that's where the numbers are today. There's the critical omitted fact here, however, is that the cost of solar has dropped approximately 70% or 80% in the last 10 years. The cost of wind has dropped about 60% in the last 10 years. There are wind projects being bid into RFPs for Texas utilities where the cost of electricity from a wind project is about $22 a megawatt hour. From a solar project, it's in the high 30s, $37 or $38 a megawatt hour. For new gas, it was $58 a megawatt hour, and for new coal, it was in the high 60s. Now, there are subsidies, you know, there are cross subsidies all through there, including for the fossil fuels, not just for the renewables, but most of the projections we've seen from Bloomberg and a number of other folks who are looking at forward cost curves for different electric energy resources are showing the costs of wind, solar, and storage continuing to drop pretty dramatically over the next 10 to 20 years. The cost of storage is going to be still dropping dramatically. The cost of gas is so low at this point, nobody sees it going down. Most people see it going up incrementally. You know, the cost of coal simply stays high. So we're seeing the renewable resource technology costs having dropped substantially in the last 10 to 20 years, continuing to do so. but we also see them cost competitive, at least in places where the resource is really good, like Texas for wind, like Arizona for solar, cost competitive today in open RFPs. And while our wind isn't as good as Texas's and our solar isn't as good as Arizona's, you know, in places it is not all that much inferior. So we would expect that by the late 2020s that the wind and the solar will be cost competitive with gas here and will beat coal out completely. It's one of the reasons coal has dropped from being 50% of our electricity source 10 years ago to being under 30% today. And it's going to continue to drop. And again, these aren't my projections. These are projections by folks like Bloomberg.
And with respect, the EPA has helped you a bit.
I'm sorry?
I said with respect, the EPA has helped you a bit.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Senator Whitson, and I believe it's helped you too. Continue? Oh, I'm sorry.
Senator Olson.
Thank you. I noticed in the projections here for Pacific Core, they're going to drop by 2030 down to about 3 million metric tons, whereas in just a little bit beyond that 2034, PGE is going to drop down to 4.5 and then go up over 5. How does Pacific Core base that presumption when they need a base load and solar and wind won't provide it? So where are they going to get their base load from?
So, Senator Edwards, Senator Olson, one of the things we've been working rather successfully on here in the Pacific Northwest over the last 10, 12 years was a project that I helped get started with BPA and the Power Council to take a look at what's required to integrate variable resources like wind and solar. You're right. You know, if the wind's not blowing, the wind turbine's not generating electricity. But that doesn't mean that they can't be used to provide reliable electricity. What you have to do is you have to marry them up with a storage technology of some sort. And there are a lot of different storage technologies. The one we are most used to in the Pacific Northwest is hydro reservoir storage, which you can use and which we are using a lot of today to integrate wind. But there are other options. You can integrate it with a gas combined cycle or a single cycle gas turbine. Particularly some of the newer designs that are built to start early, ramp up very fast, and they're designed specifically so they can be primarily used to integrate wind and solar. There are, as I mentioned, storage technologies. There are batteries. There is underground compressed air storage. There's a whole range of storage technologies. Some of them are as mundane as overheating the water in your hot water heater so that you basically have some electricity you can sell back to the utility when it needs it if the wind stopped blowing, and add up a lot of hot water heaters, and that's a fair amount of storage capability right there. So what we will see in the electric utility of the future is not so much, you know, a series of baseload plants with their own capability to meet, to follow load and meet capacity demands, but a mix of variable technologies like wind and solar combined with storage technologies that basically fill in the valleys and capture the peaks. And some of them, for example, may well be, and there's a fair amount of work that's been done on this, to the extent that we enlarge our fleet of electric vehicles so that we predominantly have a fleet of electric vehicles, we'll be able to plug those electric vehicles into the grid. During the day, the utility will either add electricity to the battery or, within limits, subtract electricity from the battery so that when you add up, you know, 15 or 20 or 30,000 electric vehicles, you've got a lot of battery storage capability that you can use to integrate the wind and solar. And I should just say that of the 1, 2, 3, 4 four competing integrated resource plans that PGE is considering right now, one is predominantly gas with significant renewables. Three are predominantly renewables with some significant gas. And all four meet reliability tests.
Okay. Would you continue?
Moving along? Okay. So I'm not going to go over this. This is the goes to the question of what we're going to do, particularly in the next 4 years, when the support and assistance from the national administration is liable to be eroded. And the answer is we're going to have to do it ourselves. But we're already far along on the path toward doing it ourselves nationally and in a number of states, both red and blue states, that are making significant wind and solar commitments. So we're not going to hang any time on this. I do want to spend a little bit of time on forest carbon emissions. I know that's of interest to the chair and I assume to others as well. Forest carbon is a pretty big deal in Oregon. You know, we have about a 60 million ton a year emissions level. There's approximately 3 billion tons of carbon tied up in our public and private forests, forest land, and the soils underneath those forests. A lot of it. We don't have very good numbers. Senator Olson, this speaks to one of your questions. We don't have very good numbers about forest carbon. And so it's very difficult to make policies, you know, that have to do with fire management, with biomass extraction for energy production, with a whole set of uses and interventions in that forest until we have a baseline, and we know what that baseline is. So one of the tasks that the commission has taken on in the last couple of years is seeing whether working with industry, working with academia, and particularly the School of Forestry at OSU, and working with a number of other folks, whether we can establish what that forest accounting baseline is, establish how it fluctuates back and forth on a background basis, as it were, because it doesn't stay stable and it changes from kind of forest to kind of forest, but just understand how it's working under pre-climate change and pre-intervention conditions. Then try to put it within a frame of climate change. As climate change occurs, as we look at some of those considerations that Kathy laid out for you, what's that going to do to our forests? You know, what does that mean for how we use our forests? And then we look at interventions. We look at extraction for commercial logging. We look at forest biomass converted to energy, and we ask, when we intervene, what is the effect on the accumulated carbon and the carbon flux in that forest when we intervene? Are we increasing carbon? Are we decreasing carbon? Are we increasing it in one place and decreasing it in another? How do those things interact with basic forest health issues? And particularly, but not exclusively, fire. And then finally, we want to look at substitution effects. If we take a log out of a forest and we convert it to a wood frame, and we put that door frame in a house, and it stays in that house for 50 years, how do we account for that within that carbon accounting structure? Do we count it as sequestered carbon for 50 years, and then do we count it as expended carbon after that 50-year period is over? And I should just say by way of disclosure that my foundation is working with Portland General Electric and with Ochoco Lumber out of John Day, try to explore whether there is a way we can convert the Boardman Power Plant to a summer-winter biomass peaking unit. So it would only operate in the summer and the winter. It could function in part as one of those integrating resources. But if we do that, what are the carbon consequences of that? Are we gaining carbon in the forest? Are we losing carbon in the forest? Are we losing a little bit of carbon in the forest, but we're gaining significantly in forest health? Right now, we don't know. So we are working as a commission, as I said, with those other parties to see if we can come up with some answers to that. And we know this is a subject of interest to the legislature. And rather than the legislature, you know, succumbing to a simple formula like all forest biomass is carbon neutral or no forest biomass is carbon neutral, we want to give the legislature, you know, at least the information that allows them to make some judgments about what kinds of management practices and interventions make sense and what kinds do not, at least from a carbon perspective. So we hope to have some information for you on that in our report in January, but certainly not the complete information, which we are going to try to get to you sometime next year.
Mr. Chair?
Yep.
As long as you're talking about that forest mass and carbon, when you're doing your work, could you find out whether an old growth tree consumes more carbon than 100 new plantings?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, the answer to that, as to so many other things in this field, is it depends. In West Side Forest, particularly Douglas fir, they are still accumulating significant amounts of additional carbon in old growth Douglas fir forests. On the other hand, you go to a lodgepole forest on the east side, and it's not accumulating significant new carbon, and in fact, it really needs a fire to come through and burn it down and release the seeds from the lodgepole cones to regenerate that forest. So the carbon accounting in a lodgepole forest is going to be very different from in a Douglas fir forest, and I wish I could tell you today exactly how I think that's going to come out, but I don't know yet because we don't have the data and the analysis from the folks who are working on this for us. But yes, we will try to be able to answer that question, and almost certainly it will be different from geographical region to geographical region and kind of forest to kind of forest.
You got 4 minutes.
Oh, unfair.
You had lots of time, and now you no longer have lots of time.
Do I get time off for? There we go. All right. So I mentioned this. This is the subset of that earlier chart that I showed you, that showed our transportation emissions, sector emissions, and as you can see, from peaking at about just before the recession, we have had emissions dropping in the transportation sector through about 2013 before they started bending back up again. You know, why is this happening? Well, this is at least one reason, and again, we're trying to not just give you the greenhouse gas emissions data, but also dig a little bit behind that. These are the most current VMT, vehicle miles traveled, numbers for the state of Oregon, and as you can see, while they dropped pretty dramatically just before and during the recession, since the recovery has taken hold and gotten traction, they've started to go up again, in addition to which, the auto manufacturers are starting to put out more larger, less fuel efficient vehicles within, you know, the limitations of federal CAFE standards. So we think those are probably the reasons why this is going up. You'll recall that transportation is our largest single greenhouse gas emission sector. You will also recall that you're going to be looking at a transportation bill in 2017, to which we hope that there will be a clean transportation component that will address these kinds of issues and address them in ways that the State Department of Transportation, you know, over a period of about 3 years and with a lot of stakeholders, including myself, worked on trying to come up with a strategy for reducing greenhouse gas emissions consistent with the goals that you as the legislature set.
Senator Whitsitt, then Dembrow, then Olson.
Thank you.
In conjunction with these two, looking at the vehicle miles traveled,
yes,
that appears to me to be a function of fuel prices, not population and not economy. If you look at the dates on there, it looks like it's fuel price to me. And then you look at the one that's on the slide on the screen. Over from 2017 to, or from 2010 or roughly to 2017, we're looking at a 19% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions already, in spite of the fact that the mileage travel is going up, so that would not appear to be a function of big vehicles to me. So what is driving that 19% or almost a 20% drop in greenhouse gas emissions in that period of time?
Second. In this period of time here?
No, that's mileage there. I'm talking about greenhouse gas emissions, your next one.
Oh. So I'm sorry. This is a chart from the greenhouse gas strategy that was produced in 2013, those numbers, you know, were 2010 numbers. So
these are projections, not actual.
So I'm sorry. So yes, these were projections.
That would explain it.
Yeah, so I apologize for that.
Okay.
But certainly the increase in emissions, you know, is partly a function of VMT going up, partly a function of additional population in the state, because we have had population increases in the last couple of years, and partly a function of a change in the fleet fuel economy, the fleet makeup over the last couple of years.
Population increase has been pretty much linear in this and that.
Senator, I'm going to defer to you on that until I can look at some population numbers, because I don't want to say something that is going to be wrong, but I'll check it.
Senator Deborah. Yeah, thanks, Mr. Chair. And I will say a lot of those new Oregonians are living in Portland and they don't drive, actually. But my question about the chart on the vehicle miles traveled, do you know how much of that, what the amount of commercial or, commercial fleet miles as opposed to individual family?
Not off the...
Are those broken out? I mean, could...
Yeah.
Is some of that due to increased commercial activity during the recovery or, just trying to understand?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator Dembro, almost certainly it is a function of both of those, and I don't have the breakout. I actually got this chart about 48 hours ago, so we don't have the breakdown on that. But it's a good question. It's one that we ought to know and understand. And if I figure it out, I will get back to you on it.
Thank you.
All right. Continue. Senator Olson already said that.
Oh, okay. All right. So I have, four more minutes, Mr. Chairman?
No. We need to be...
All right. We're skipping this one.
We got a couple more things to
do. That's way too complicated. But basically what it says is if we want to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, we have to have lower carbon in our fuels. We have to particularly shift over from internal combustion engines to electric vehicles and plug them into, an electrical grid that is as clean as the plan, the assumptions had are for electricity, for the required reductions in electricity. We have to substantially increase our accessibility and reach, of transit, particularly in the Tri-County area and in Lane County. And we have to have, urban designs that over time are supportive of heavier transit corridors. We don't have to have apartment houses, in every block in every city, but along major transit corridors, we do have to have increased, both commercial and residential densities. I am also not going to spend any time on this, although we should, because this is an area in which the state of Oregon is, frankly, far behind. All we have at this point is a framework that was developed back in 2010 by a very good group of agency people and agency heads, but it's now 6 years out of date, and it was not particularly comprehensive then. You heard some of the discussion that Kathy described about the issues we expect to confront and that we are we are substantially unprepared to deal with those issues. There are certain agencies that are stepping up to this. There are certain communities, particularly Portland, Eugene, Corvallis, that are stepping up to adaptation and preparation work. But as a state, we are not. We're finally getting around to dealing with tsunami preparedness. That's a good idea. But we need to be doing climate risk preparedness as well, and we are not. Last point I want to make, and this carries over from the prior slide as well, and that is generally we don't have a very systematic way of making climate policy and then following to see whether it is carried out in the state. And I can speak on behalf of my commission because we do our best to punch above our weight, but we don't have the resources and we don't have the analytic tools to do the analysis that would support the best choices of policies. We don't have accountability within the state, so different agencies may take up one issue and not another. The State Department of Transportation may take up transportation planning along the coast where inundation may be a possibility, but they may or may not be coordinating with Department of Land Conservation and Development. The Global Warming Commission is the one that's supposed to be doing this. If you go back to our 2007 Organic Act, where it said, here are the things the Global Warming Commission should be doing, well, that's actually just the start of them. That's some of the rest of them, but I didn't include all of the slides. It doesn't have to be my commission. As far as I'm concerned, if you all have a better way to do this, you know, terminate my commission and set up another way that is going to systematically track who's responsible for what the benchmarks are that they are working toward, whether they're making their benchmarks or missing them. If they're missing them, why are they missing them? And overall, do we have a plan that is both coordinated and is making the most use of the most cost-effective tools and technologies and resources? And we don't have that today. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Angus. Yeah, Senator Olson.
On your slide number six, and you don't have to go back to it because I don't want to take that. Yeah, we don't have another 4 minutes for that.
Good thinking.
There is an area I do agree with you wholeheartedly. Sparse data on which to base policies and priorities, and we have very sparse data.
So, Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, we've found a point of agreement.
Yes,
I'm thrilled.
Yes,
I don't mean to be sarcastic. I agree wholeheartedly with you. I've had this conversation with Representative Bentz on several occasions as well. I think he's been probably the member who has been most vocal about, you know, our inability or unwillingness to really analyze what's the most cost-effective path from A to B to C. And I agree with him wholeheartedly and wish that we would come up with a way to figure this out.
Any other questions or comments for Angus? Thank you much for being here and the information and the work that you continue to do on this issue. All right, so before we move to the next panel, which is going to be a discussion about agriculture and the importance of the agricultural industry in Oregon, Dexter, could you come forward? Because we are going to be having a work session, and there arose earlier in a House committee a question about whether or not outgoing members can vote to submit committee bills. And then it sounds like there is a difference between the House rules and the Senate rules on said question. So perhaps, Dexter, you could give us an explanation of what the rules are. And because we have a couple of bills to introduce as a committee here, and we have two outgoing members of the committee that will not be here during the 2017 session.
Sure. Senator Edwards, members, good afternoon. Dexter Johnson, Legislative Council. And I'll start off by saying that the simple answer, there is not a difference between what committees can do in the Senate and the House.
Okay.
Interim committees can pre-session file pursuant to House Concurrent Resolution 209 and Senate Rule 213.09 can pre-session file committee requests that will be considered in the next session, even though committee members in this of this committee will not be present in the next session.
Okay. Senator, what's it? Did you want
to? That answers the question. It kind of brings up another question. For those of us who are not coming back, we Senate rules prevent us from introducing legislation in 2017. But it's my understanding that's true. Had we known that ahead of time, we could have introduced legislation through the committee by introducing it as a committee bill, correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator Whitsitt, that's correct. Senate committees can introduce.
That's a little late for some of us.
I
didn't know this.
Judiciary does not close until Wednesday at 5 p.m. Anyone on this dais or anyone else in the building that needs to have a venue, an opportunity to get their bills in, let us know as quick as possible. And Channel Neil will make sure that we'll do our best to make that happen. So we're one of the last committees, and this is one of the reasons we asked for that slot, is when there's these type of issues. If someone wants to
get something into the process, we're all open for it.
And what can be done, and I will be doing with one of my bills that will be submitted probably as a committee bill. It can be, or it can be submitted by another member, and then outgoing members can have at the request of, you know, it can be noted on the bill at the request of. But
yeah, I mean, that's another thing. You can actually assign whatever you've had drafted to another member.
Yeah. I just learned about this as well. So any other questions about, okay, so it sounds like what we're about to do, we're going to have a work session really quickly and introduce some LCs, and we're okay to do that as yes. The current committee can. Okay.
Yes, you are.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Okay, before the last presentation, because we're in that mindset right now, we are going to move into work session so that we can introduce the committee bill. So we're going to open up a work session for the introduction of committee measures. Senator Dembro?
Yes. Chair Edwards, I move that the following LCs be introduced as committee bills. LC 2038, dated November 2nd, 2016. LC 2216. Dated December 5th, 2016, and LC 2363, dated October 4th, 2016.
Senator Dembro moves that the following LCs be introduced as committee bills: LC 2038, dated 11/2/16, LC 2216, dated December 5th, 2016, and LC 2363, dated October 4th, 2016. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I would make a motion that those bills be separated for individual votes.
I'm happy to separate them for individual votes. So why don't we, let's see, do I need to undo them? Yes, Senator Pradonsky.
Mr. Chair, I think one thing for clarification, you may want to just give the disclaimer that we always give.
I was about to, and I want to say that before, and if we still want to move into individual votes, that's fine. It's a prerogative of the committee and committee members to do that. I've never denied anybody the opportunity to introduce a bill as a committee bill. I sat for a few sessions on Senator Byers' committee, and he always did that, and he always said, look, if any member approaches him and asks him to introduce a bill as a committee bill, he's happy to do that as a professional courtesy. Voting for the introduction of a bill by no way, in any means, expresses support for the ideas or stances or whatever, the language in the bill. It's just simply to get it in the process for consideration. So I'm comfortable voting on them as a package, but Senator Olson, would you want to vote on them individually?
Well, I would just be clear that two that I would vote no on and one I would vote yes on.
Okay. Well, let's do, let's see. Technically, the motion needs to be
withdrawn.
So if you'll withdraw your motion, we'll do them individually.
I will. How about Courtney's bill? Is that a committee bill? The trapping?
No, I think that's a personal bill.
That's a personal bill.
Yeah.
That's what okay. Three that are coming to judicial.
If you'd withdraw your motion, that'd be great. And just make them one at a time, and we'll
sure.
Vote on them.
Okay. Please consider the motion withdrawn, Mr. Chair.
Great.
Chair Edwards, I move that LC 2038, dated November 2nd, 2016, be introduced as a committee bill.
Senator Dembro has moved that LC 2038, dated November 2nd, 2016, be introduced as a committee bill. I will say, first, is there any discussion? Okay, see no discussion. Again, let the record show that voting for this bill is not a vote to affirmatively support the contents of the bill. It just gets it into the process, into the legislative process. So all those opposed? Okay, note for the record, the opposition of Senator Olson. Seeing no further opposition, the motion carries.
Mr. Chair, I move that LC 2216, dated December 5th, 2016, be introduced as a committee bill.
Senator Dembro moves that LC 2216, dated December 5th, 2016, be introduced as a committee bill. Is there any discussion? Seeing no discussion, for the record, a vote for this for introduction of this committee bill does not indicate affirmative, affirmative support of the bill. It's just to get it into the process. So, are there any objections to the introduction of LC 2216? Okay, seeing no objections, the motion carries.
Mr. Chair, I move that LC 2363, dated October 4th, 2016, be introduced as a committee bill.
Senator Denbrough moves that LC 2363, dated October 4th, 2016, be introduced as a committee bill. Is there any discussion? Seeing no discussion, let the record show that this does not constitute support for the underlying bill. It's just a vote to get the bill introduced as a committee bill so that it can get into the process. Are there any objections? Nope. For the record, the objections of Senators Olson and Whitsitt. And the motion carries. All right. That is all that are, those are all the bill introductions that we need to do. Does anybody else have any bills that you want introduced as a committee bill? I mean, I know this is like really last minute, but if, okay. Then we'll close the work session and we'll move on to the last presentation. So, Jenny Dressler, Oregon Farm Bureau, talk to us about the importance of agriculture to our state's economy.
So, Chair Edwards, members of the committee, thank you for having us today. My name is Jenny Dressler. I represent the Oregon Farm Bureau Federation. We are an association made up of about 65,000 members across the state. 7,000 of those are active farm and ranch families. Today, I feel really honored to be able to come up and talk about the value of agriculture, what it brings to the state, and then some of the challenges and opportunities that we see going forward. So I know many of you have seen this map, but we've got seven diverse growing regions in Oregon, essentially growing over 225 different commodities. And we're really lucky to have that kind of diversity. I think that we're second only to California in the diversity of the crops that we grow in Oregon. Some of the characteristics, you probably heard these stats from us several times. I think the latest number is that 97% of farms in Oregon are family-held operations. So we still have a high number of family operations in Oregon, but we are starting to see, and you probably heard at the Oregon Business Summit, of some of the succession issues and the issues with transitioning from one generation to the next. And I'll explain some of that as we go forward. I listed some of the products that Oregon is the number one and number two producer of in the nation. Among the number one, we've got ryegrass seed, red clover seed, boysenberries, and peppermint, and then in number two, spearmint, hops, and snap beans. So really cool amount of diversity here. I'm sure that when the cannabis numbers are calculated, the cannabis, depending on who's doing the tally, could rank somewhere in the top one or two, depending on production in other states. So agriculture and the economy. So many of you, again, have heard this statistic from me or from my colleagues in the ag lobby, but agriculture is Oregon's second largest traded sector industry, so very important to the economy of Oregon. We contribute to over 13% of Oregon's economic activity. That's a little over $50 billion worth of economic activity, so that's our footprint. Our farm gate value, so that's the sale value minus the market cost, is about $5.7 billion in each year. Another interesting statistic is that about 1 in 8 jobs are connected to agriculture directly and indirectly. So we are big employers in the state. Trade and transportation, I think the transportation discussion is very relevant to this committee as well as others. As you probably are very aware, Oregon agriculture in particular is very trade dependent. About 80% of the goods that we produce leave the state, and about 40% of those goods that leave the state are exported internationally. We've got an increasingly growing demand for our products in Asia, but that's all impacted as well by the loss of container shipping at the Port of Portland. And there's a lot of factors at play there, but some of the industries that it impacted were compressed hay and grass seed. So.
For sure.
Yeah. Oh.
Pardon me, Jenny.
Yes.
On the 98% loss of container traffic, could you put a dollar amount to that, what it costs farmers to transport to Tacoma?
You know, I think it's going to vary depending on how they've decided to move their goods beyond that. And I've asked my folks for that same cost impact. Depending on whether they're shipping to Tacoma or to Oakland, you're going to have different costs there. If you're going to move it by rail, I think that there's some inconsistencies in the rail system right now just due to construction. And so you might see some delay in goods that way. And then with Hanjin going bankrupt, you had some goods just sitting in different ports just being held. So you have additional costs of goods being held in different areas of the globe, actually.
So follow up. Mm-hmm. So you don't know the cost impact of farmers on the additional cost of their product getting it to market?
I could probably get you some statistics. I don't know specifically because each operation ships to a different market, and some of those markets aren't even accessible anymore, just due to the fact that you do have cost increases. Does it still pencil out, especially in unpredictable commodity years like we had this year, where the price of wheat was down, and we've been on several bad years for the dairy industry. So those market conditions are also going to play a role in the viability of each commodity. And speaking of viability, you all probably saw this infographic in 2016, and if you didn't, Oregon Farm Bureau and some of our members wanted to describe some of the challenges that we face with remaining viable as family operations. And I don't know if you can see what's kind of tipping down on this little farmer here, but you'll see kind of an abundance of issues related to ag production tools that are available to us, some of the workforce mandates that have come down, some of the other regulations that are coming around as it relates to energy production and transportation, and then just a general federal overlay that's pretty challenging. And I'll kind of go into some of those details, but our message has been that it's not one issue that's going to make or break a farm operation. In any year, it's the accumulation of these issues coming down, of these policies coming down, and the inability for our folks to adapt at the same at the rate that they're coming down, that's forcing them out or forcing them to sell to larger operations. So I'll start with some of those workforce challenges. As you saw, we are a very trade dependent state. And the policies, some of the policies that we've passed reduce the competitiveness of our family operations. The sick time law, I don't know how many of you in this room heard, but Bully did not move forward with their decision they reopened the rules this summer, but did not move forward with some of the changes that were proposed. Some of those would have provided clarity that was much needed to our members, and then other fixes are still needed going forward to help our folks kind of streamline that policy. Our operations look very different. HR is often the husband or wife on the farm or the brother or sister, and there's not a separate department or office. So there's some of the requirements associated with the sick time law have been very difficult for our folks to kind of get a handle on. Same with the three-tiered minimum wage. I think that one of the big challenges with the minimum wage is that farms don't necessarily obey county boundaries. But additionally, you've got a minimum wage that has three different regions, essentially, that it applies to, and then a sick time law that applies to Portland and the rest of the state, and the boundaries don't match up. And again, you've got these family HR businesses sitting there saying, well, shoot, you know, we have a farm stand in Portland 3 months out of the year, so do I qualify for sick time or don't I? And then, but I'm located in Albany, so which minimum wage am I paying? I think it's very confusing for somebody who's just trying to get a handle on everything that they need to comply with going forward. Third is state retirement for the private sector. It should not be a huge, it's not a financial burden, obviously, for employers, but it is a fairly significant HR burden. Honestly, a lot of interactions between employers and employees will happen, like, in a field. You know, somebody says, oh, wait, I don't want to be a part of this plan anymore. And you've got just these conversations happening that our folks, that they may not have the chance to go back to the office and record everything in that very moment. And so just the way that these businesses are set up make it quite a bit challenging to accommodate some of the intricacies of these laws. I spoke a little bit to the HR burden. The other issue that I think you all are very familiar with for us is labor shortages. And we've had an increasingly difficult time finding labor during the critical time of harvest. The shortage in the competition for workers also means that prices are elevated for our workforce. And for Oregon agriculture, many producers are price takers. Not all, but certainly many are price takers, which means that when they're operating in these national and global markets, that they're unable to set the price of the products that they produce. And that's what puts a crunch on them with some of these regulatory burdens, but also some of the other burdens that we'll talk about that might be being considered this coming legislative session. So, and we'll move on to that. From a transportation perspective, obviously, it's an important issue to us that we have the infrastructure needed to move goods, especially with the closure of the port. So moving our goods to market is a number one priority for our industry, and we believe that a transportation package is probably going to help us do that more efficiently and cost-effectively. An issue, especially with the port closure, is going to be the cost of transportation in general, and whether it's a low-carbon fuel standard or a renewable fuel standard or another policy, we're looking at the actual cost and how that's going to impact each producer. And again, in those really tough market years, that's a challenge for us. Energy is the same. I don't know that you saw us much on the. On the coal phase out and the RPS bill, we did oppose it, and largely because, not because we believe that coal needs to be a part of the mix, but largely again because it takes energy to produce food and fiber. It takes energy to keep our operations going, and any increased cost to ratepayers are going to be felt, especially by thin margin industries such as ourselves. Some of the proposed regulations that we're definitely keeping an eye on are the diesel mandate. Again, we don't have, I think farmers are often land rich or asset rich and capital poor. So they're sitting on a lot of equipment that might be used for only, 2 to 8 weeks a year. And they don't have that ability to go in and make big sweeping changes to the infrastructure that they have in place. Cap and trade is the same. We've talked about the cost of producing food and fiber. Any extra cost is going to pinch those family businesses. And then just a general patchwork of regulations. And it's, again, I don't think that it's any surprise to any of you, but a patchwork of crop of pesticide laws where in one county you have one regulation and another, there's a different. That would be incredibly challenging for these businesses that are going to operate across county lines they're going to operate across the entire state often. Biotechnology, that's maintaining that regulatory flexibility so that we can move into the future and use technology that could help conserve water in the future. There's some really interesting areas that we can move into there. And then finally, animal health. There's been some proposals over the past 2 years that would limit our access to animal health tools. And on top of creating a burden for family operations and potentially increasing sickness and disease mortality in herds, it's an animal welfare issue for us, and we care about the health and well-being of our animals. And so we're going to be looking to maintain that level playing field for Oregon producers across the country. Along that end, especially as it relates to animal health, it's not just local regulations that are going to impact our operations and the economic viability. We've got a changing federal landscape that impacts the viability of our operations as well. And with regard to animal health, we have a new judicious use strategy coming out of the FDA, which is a complete overhaul of how animal health tools are regulated at the federal level, providing veterinary oversight over those antibiotics that are used in both human and animal health, those ones that are important to the public health community. It's a big step for our community. There's going to be some big changes, and we're working to try to implement those right now. That will be law on January 1st of 2017. The Food Safety Modernization Act, passed in 2011, The rules have been finalized over the past couple of years by the FDA, overhaul of the nation's food safety system. And Oregon Farm Bureau, and I know that many of our partners in this room probably and elsewhere are working to implement that to the best of our abilities and to try to streamline that for our folks, because we recognize the importance of a safe food supply. I've listed four of the rules. The Food Safety Modernization Act includes 7 rules. Four of the ones that I listed are going to be important for, especially for Oregon producers. And that includes the food processors for both animal feed and human food, produce safety grower, or the produce safety rule, which is going to apply to produce growers, and then sanitary transportation, which is going to apply across the supply chain. Other federal regulations that are changing the landscape with which we work in include the EPA's Worker Protection Standard, which is going to change. It's an update to the current Worker Protection Standard concerned with worker safety around pesticide use. And then Endangered Species Act, you'll see a list of different Endangered Species Act issues that Oregon farmers are kind of grappling with right now as they try to adjust to this changing regulatory landscape. So I guess in summary, Oregon agriculture is a really important industry in Oregon. It's an incredibly large industry in Oregon, but in order to maintain the success, especially in these rough years, we need to maintain regulatory flexibility. And that means both at the state and federal level for us and also in legal decisions as we move forward. So I appreciate the opportunity to provide testimony, and I'm available for any comments.
Questions or comments from members of the committee? Senator Wilson.
Thank you, Chair Edwards. Jenny, you pointed out that Oregon is number one in Christmas trees, hazel, loganberries, and so forth. But that's not the largest sector in Oregon. By far the largest sector in Oregon is beef cattle, followed by nursery.
Beef cattle, followed by nursery.
Nursery,
stock.
Followed by dairy, followed mm-hmm. by hay. So if you take the cattle sector, beef, dairy, and hay, they dwarf anything else in the state.
Yes.
And when you're talking about the changes to diesel and fuel and so forth, that is huge in both the dairy and
the livestock.
Beef,
yeah.
The beef industry, we're constantly hauling cattle. You know, 1 month in the spring and 1 month in the fall, so to speak, and mm-hmm. other 10 months those trucks just sit there, So that you can't really have a $100,000 truck sitting in the barn 10 months out of the year. And one particular dairy that we have in the climate theory milks about 2,500, 3,000 head of cows. It's preponderantly an organic dairy. They run a fleet of trucks. And you've probably seen the Milky Way trucks. Those trucks are really not a problem to keep up with the diesel standard. But the fleet of trucks that they have on the ranch that are Army surplus, that they can afford to keep and run 2 months out of the year or 3 months out of the year when they're harvesting, those are not new trucks that can be upgraded. Mm-hmm. End of sermon. Thank you.
Can I give a counter sermon? just because, that's very relevant to some work that I'm doing. I just want to say that as we finalize the proposals on diesel, we definitely will be taking into account the frequency of, you know, the number of miles being traveled. And, we're trying to really make improvements in high-density areas and with high-volume users. Thank you for that comment.
All right. Thank you for the presentation. Folks, we are done. Senator Whitsitt, thank you for your service on this committee. I think this is the last committee meeting for both of us.
Thank you for your service on this committee as well.
Yeah, and I think it took you too many sessions to get to this committee, but you got here. And I enjoyed working with you on the committee. And to the two rowdy guys at the end, I enjoyed my service with you on this committee. When the Senate President first assigned me to chair the committee, I thought for sure that Floyd was going to be my most difficult committee member, and
just sat down there just nice all the time and just didn't say anything. And so,
wait a minute. I just said that a little bit. I think he's casting aspersions my way.
No, I didn't say that at all. Yeah. I did not say
that. I thought Florida's going to be the worst.
We've taken on a lot of really difficult issues. I think it's very difficult to talk about the environment and natural resource dependent economies in a state like Oregon without. Wading into the middle of very divergent points of view, divergent lifestyles, divergent economies, urban versus rural. And I think that, overall, while we didn't always agree with one another, I think we conducted ourselves well. So thank you for all of you guys for the honor to chair this committee and work with you. And we'll see you.
See you down the road. So. I put my name in the hat to fill your chair. So.
All right.
All right. Well, see what gets drawn out.
Yeah.
We should have all worn our caps that Senator Olson gave us today about how, what did it say? How it's hard to be green or.
That was, yeah, I gave those out.
Yeah. Oh, I'll always see you in that cap.
Yeah, yeah, right.
Uh-huh. Okay, so with that, we're adjourned. With that, we're adjourned. So.